Welcome back to Night Nation Review. This is Night Nation Review, and we are live to you.
Holocaust Encyclopedia, An Introduction. After more than 30 years of intense archival and forensic research, critical Holocaust scholars have amassed a veritable deluge of publications. It is so voluminous, in fact, that no one can wrap their head around it anymore without proper guidance. But no such guidance has existed so far. Hence, the project to create such a guidance in the shape of an encyclopedia was born in early 2022. As with any such reference work, the idea is to allow both the novice and the expert to quickly find all the pertinent information and references to further reading about any relevant keyword that may come to mind. And here it is. The following will give a brief overview of this reference work, how it is structured, and what you can expect to find in it. We start out by looking up the one entry in this book that lies at the center, the one on the Holocaust. For anyone trying to get a general understanding of this topic, that's the best place to start. It starts out by giving a few examples of the use of this term in connection with the persecution of Jews that appeared in newspapers prior to the Second World War, in fact, even before the First World War. There are many more examples like this, but I need to be brief here. The first mass media use of this term in connection with what we today call the Holocaust occurred in 1942. The term Holocaust became generally accepted as referring to the fate of the Jews during World War II, due to the enormous success of the 1978 fiction movie Holocaust, from which I have taken these initial scenes. Next, a definition is given as has been broadly accepted by mainstream scholars for many decades now. It consists of three main pillars. First, the assertion that Germany's National Socialist authorities had the intention, and a plan, to murder the Jews within their range; second, that they had devised specific instruments and tools to implement that plan. This includes first and foremost the iconic gas chambers as well as cremation furnaces or pyres to dispose of the bodies. Third, the result of this all is said to have amounted to about 6 million Jewish victims. The Holocaust is moreover considered unique in history because of the overall plan, its attempt to kill all or at least most Jews, and the high-tech manner in which it all was carried out. The encyclopedia addresses all the aspects of these claims. However, in order to avoid ballooning out of proportion, this reference work does not address aspects of the fate of the Jews in wartime Europe that are not unique. This concerns anti-Jewish discrimination, the forced settlement or admission of Jews in ghettos and concentration camps, as well as occasional massacres. While they are all deplorable and very much real, they have happened before in history to Jews and non-Jewish population groups. Since these aspects are not directly connected to an implemented plan of total physical annihilation, they are not included. To give the reader an idea of what we are dealing with, when we are talking about quote-unquote the Holocaust, this entry contains a flow chart that lists all major aspects of this term. As you can see, this term encompasses an awful lot. In fact, it covers thousands of individual events and claimed crime scenes, spread out over an entire continent, and scattered throughout some 4 years. It therefore makes little sense to talk about the Holocaust as one monolithic event. This encyclopedia gives you a tool to understand, first, what the Holocaust was, or is claimed to have been, in all its essential aspects. The chart you see here is included in the print, e-book and online editions, with the EPUB and online versions having links for each item listed, leading to the respective entry. Second, this encyclopedia has something no similar work can offer, a guide to all the pertinent evidence. This chart shows the complex nature of all the evidence claimed to exist for the Holocaust. This evidence and its discussion are divided into physical evidence, meaning material traces of the claimed crimes, such as the bodies or murder weapons. Next, we have wartime documents. Let me quickly address a few of the groups listed here. First, we have air photos taken during the war, showing what was transpiring at certain claimed crime scenes, which can be used to juxtapose it to claims made by self-proclaimed witnesses. British radio intercepts include radio messages the SS sent from their various camps to the headquarters near Berlin. Not knowing that the British had cracked their code, hence believing that they communicated safely and secretly, these intercepts describe in clear language what was happening in those camps. This can be contrasted with the messages the Polish underground sent to their government in exile in London. Hence, the British recognized in real time that the Poles were making up invented or wildly exaggerated claims about alleged German atrocities. Finally, we have the large group of witness testimony. The encyclopedia has a list of more than 300 witnesses, whose statements are summarized and analyzed. I will return to the issue of testimonies later. One aspect of the Holocaust you will not find addressed in any mainstream publication is manipulation, which is addressed in three crucial entries: censorship, propaganda, and indoctrination. Let's start with the latter. Four main aspects are addressed: the fact that, in Western countries, school students are forced to learn the official narrative of this event, and have to read literature about it, such as Elie Wiesel's novel, Night, which is presented as fact rather than fiction. While one of the ideals of Western education is to teach students a critical discerning mind, this attitude is near impossible when it comes to the Holocaust. In fact, in most European countries it is even illegal. Therefore, in Western societies, children are inculcated with a one-sided story without any option to dissent or critically analyze what they are being fed. Next come Holocaust museums and memorials. Take the example of the United States or the UK. Neither of these countries were perpetrators, contributors, or victims of the Holocaust, yet the sheer number of Holocaust museums and memorials in both countries dwarfs any other historical event by far. Commemorating an event that happened in a foreign country has become an obsession for all Western countries. Next, consider that, in the English language alone, some 4 books on the Holocaust are getting published every single day. The situation is similar with movies and documentaries. They peaked around the turn of the millennium and have since eased off a little, but remain on an extremely high level, compared to all other historical events. The topic of wartime and post-war propaganda is covered in this encyclopedia with a rather long entry. Considering that this encyclopedia has some 600 entries on some 600 pages, hence the average entry is about a page long, compare this to the 12 pages of this entry. It is organized alphabetically by country, with entries for Czechoslovakia, France, Germany, Poland, Serbia, the Soviet Union, the UK, and the US. At the end, Jewish contributions to wartime and post-war propaganda are addressed as well. As promised, we return to the topic of evidence. This encyclopedia has actually a dedicated entry that explains what evidence is, which categories of evidence exist, and what their respective value is. The last 2 entries in this list are rendered in grey, because strictly speaking, witness testimony is not evidence. If a person claims something, it is a claim. If he claims that others claim the same thing, it's merely an assembly of many claims. As shown before, this encyclopedia has a chart showing all kinds of evidence discussed in it, and how it is organized. It is also contained in the print version of this book. The online version has links leading to each listed item, if an entry for it exists. To explain the dilemma that witness testimony put historians in, let me briefly discuss 2 examples: testimony about the alleged pure extermination camps Belzec and Sobibor. Let's start with Belzec. Like all entries on the camps that are said to have been the main staging grounds of the Holocaust, Belzec's entry starts out with a summary of the camp's documented history, which is rather short, because not many documents about this camp have survived. This is followed by a summary of the camp's propaganda history, starting with early witness claims and Polish underground messages, through claims made in the immediate post-war era, and later developments. This overview demonstrates how the narrative about this camp has changed over time. This is followed by a list of claimed death tolls for Belzec, ranging from 3 million claimed by Rudolf Redder, a former camp inmate, down to 300,000 victims asserted in the post-war verdict of a West German court. Next discussed are the results of forensic investigations, where the claims are put to the only real-world test that matters: where are the traces of the claimed victims and murder weapons? Such forensic research was conducted in several camps between 1999 and 2014. The results are rarely discussed by mainstream scholars because they are difficult to reconcile with the orthodox narrative. Here is a table giving a few results of the Belzec forensic investigations. While today some 434,000 victims are claimed, research has found only scattered traces. Whereas the claimed murder victims would have occupied a mass grave space of at least some 72,000 cubic meters, soundings in the camp area have found disturbed soil at most some 21,000 cubic meters, and that includes the disturbed soil of earlier digs in the camp area. In other words, there is no way the number of claimed victims can have been buried in this camp. Hence, the forensic findings refute the mainstream narrative. Another issue is the amount of wood, which would have been needed to cremate the number of bodies claimed. I will return to the issue of firewood later. So how was this evidently false narrative formed to begin with? It is based entirely on witness statements, such as those claiming that pigs can fly. Well, they can't, and that's the problem. In the case of Belzec, only three witnesses made detailed statements in the immediate post-war period. First, we have former SS officer Kurt Gerstein. While in French captivity after the war, and shortly before committing suicide there, he claimed that murder was committed with diesel engine exhaust gases in a small concrete building containing 6 gas chambers. The problem with his various statements is that they are full of preposterous, physically impossible, contradictory and even absurd claims, which is the reason why nowadays not even mainstream historians consider him a reliable witness anymore. Next, we have former inmate Rudolf Redder, whom I mentioned earlier. As an engine mechanic, he claims to have maintained an absurdly complex machinery, including a gasoline engine. He stated that this machine was used for the murder, but that he could not figure out how death was meted out. Yet he insisted that the engine's exhaust gas was not used for the murder, but was directly vented outdoors. Like Gerstein, he also asserted that the gassing facility was made of concrete and contained 6 gas chambers. However, he claimed that it measured 100 times 100 meters square, which is an absurdly large size. Similar to Gerstein, his testimony is also riddled with preposterous, physically impossible, contradictory and even absurd claims. Hence, Redder is today considered unreliable by mainstream historians as well. This leaves us with witness number 3, Stanislav Kozak. This Polish civilian claimed to have been involved in building a 3-chamber wooden hut, which was equipped with coke furnaces and lots of water pipes. This indicates that the building he constructed was either a shower and or a hot steam disinfestation facility. He did not claim that the facility served to murder anyone. And here is what the Polish judiciary, leading among them investigative judge Łukaszkiewicz, and mainstream historians following in their footsteps, made of this tangled mess of flying pigs. First, in order to overcome the fundamental contradiction between Redder's and Gerstein's claim on the one hand and Kozak's on the other, regarding the nature of the relevant building, they invented the history of two phases. In the camp's first phase, the gas chamber building consisted of a wooden shack with 3 gas chambers, whereas later a larger building made of concrete with 6 chambers was erected. Next, they invented the murder weapon by ignoring Kozak's hot water facility, and by turning Redder's explicit denial of an exhaust gas murder into the exact opposite. The murder was done with engine exhaust gases, which later mutated into a diesel engine to boot, based on Gerstein's testimonies. That both Redder and Gerstein lacked any credibility was generously ignored. Now, let's take a look at the Sobibor camp. We open the relevant pages in the encyclopedia. It's organized the same way as the entry on Belzec. Let me go straight to a table listing the claims made by all the witnesses who testified shortly after the war, mostly interviewed by Judge Łukaszkiewicz and his team. I copy this date over to a larger, split table. The rightmost column contains claims about the mechanics of the claimed gas chamber. Almost all witnesses agreed that the chamber's floor opened up after the execution, dumping the bodies into carts running on tracks in a space beneath the building. Many witnesses claimed that murder was committed with chlorine. Some mentioned an unspecified gas, and others insisted that the gas was fed through shower heads. Several witnesses agreed that the murder was observed by the SS executioner through roof windows. Not a single witness claimed that engine exhaust gas was used for the murder. In contrast to that, here is the narrative quote-unquote established by Judge Vukashkiewicz. In his report summarizing his investigations, he insisted that the murder was committed using engine exhaust gas, that the gas was fed through normal pipes into the chamber, hence not through showerheads, that there was no observation window in the roof, that the floors did not open up, and that the bodies were carried out through doors rather than dumped into carts running beneath. There was not a single witness who said anything resembling this. So where did Vukashkiewicz find his story? He copied and pasted it from the chapter preceding his summary of Sobibor. He took it from his chapter about Belzec. After all, having wildly disparate claims about each and every alleged extermination camp makes no sense at all, and floors opening up to discharge bodies into carts beneath is such a technically absurdly complicated solution that no German engineer would ever have contemplated, let alone implemented this. Thus, no one in his right mind would ever believe such a story. Therefore, Vukashkiewicz discarded all witness testimony and cloned the story he had just invented for Belzec. He later did the same with the Treblinka camp. This story is what subsequently was rammed down the public's throat by all quote-unquote expert historians and by trial verdicts relying on these quote-unquote experts. And if you don't want to believe it and say so publicly, you go to prison in more than 20 Western countries. Another Polish investigative judge, Jan Zane, led a similar, but much more complex and long-lasting effort with regard to the Auschwitz camp. Numerous entries in the encyclopedia deal with this topic. The question that comes to mind is, why was especially the Polish judiciary so hellbent at creating this extermination narrative? First, like with all the other victorious powers, developing and spreading such stories was seen as the continuation of the war by means of psychological warfare. But more than that, Poland had put itself in a precarious position at war's end by accepting and getting involved in the largest land heist and ethnic cleansing Europe had ever seen, the expulsion of some 7 million Germans from their ancestral homelands in East Germany, and the annexation of these lands by Poland. Let me explain that with a map. This map shows Germany's territorial losses, first after the First World War, yellow, then after the Second World War, green, pink and orange. Here, we are talking about the green territories, from which Poland expelled all German residents. If you put the borders of today's Poland onto this map, you'd realize that basically half of its territory consists of land taken from Germany after two world wars. That's not a good position to be in when facing a much stronger neighbor who, in some distant future, might be out to get back what was robbed from them. So, it was absolutely crucial for Poland's survival to implement a plan that would put a stop to any German territorial demands for all future. The Germans call the politics implemented by Poland Rabsicherungspolitik, which literally translates to robbery securing policy, meaning a policy designed to secure the spoils of history's greatest robbery ever. The plan was to lay a massive guilt trip on the Germans for having perpetrated history's most atrocious genocide ever, and thus making them accept any kind of punishment. The other victorious powers were all on the same page, and the project ended up being extremely successful. I am not going into more details here. Suffice it to say that this is no longer an issue today. Both Germany and Poland are facing the demographic collapse of their respective indigenous populations, so they cannot even populate the areas they currently occupy, let alone think of any expansionist politics. Having touched upon the motives for rigging the record in the way it was done, and is explained and demonstrated in detail in the encyclopedia, it is worthwhile broaching the issue of motives in general for all groups involved to create and propagate their respective version of what happened with the Jews in Europe during World War II. With this, we leave the realm of the factual and demonstrable, and enter the morass of politics, psychology and thus to some degree of speculation. there are many players involved in developing and spreading narratives on and around the Holocaust. The mainstream, commonly consisting of what we call here Holocaust dogmatists, usually only asks what motives quote-unquote Holocaust deniers have for their alleged evil machinations. While investigating the motives of a marginalized minority may be interesting, it is much more important to investigate the motives of those who use their power to imprison dissidents, burn their books, and ban all their utterances from all communication channels of society. Such tyrannical behavior must have strong political motivations and is dangerous for any society if left unchecked. Holocaust dogmatists commonly incorrectly lump skeptics, who don't take claims at face value and ask critical questions, together with deniers, who, just like the dogmatists, subordinate truth and accuracy to some other, usual political agenda. Finally, it is worthwhile asking what motives the National Socialists had for their viral anti-Jewish stance. In its entry on motives, our reference book looks into the motives of all four groups on a little more than 6 pages. Returning back to the evidence, our encyclopedia bustles with entries on testimonies and their claims. It moreover contains numerous entries that address commonly made, false claims about the Holocaust, and entries which address forces that have a rather deleterious effect on witnesses to be truthful. Here is a list of entries addressing untrue claims frequently made by witnesses. Like widespread medieval claims of witches riding on broomsticks through the sky, and having sex with the devil, which medieval judges took as corroboration that it must be true, because hundreds of witnesses have claimed it, these false statements also point to a convergence of many witness accounts into, not the truth, but the pervasive nature of Holocaust clichés among witnesses, which are not based on facts, but on rumors and lore. I will not go into any details of them here. Let us just look briefly into 4 of these entries, starting with flames shooting out of crematorium chimneys. Here is the list of all the witnesses who claimed that flames were shooting out of crematorium chimneys at Auschwitz. Of course, the respective entry first demonstrates that this claim cannot be true, before listing the witnesses who claimed otherwise. In this case, the cremation furnaces of Auschwitz were coke-fired. Coke produces basically no flame. Furthermore, the distance from the cremation muffle to the exit of the chimney was more than 20 meters. Hence, flames could impossibly come out of these chimneys. Had they done so anyhow, these chimneys would have soon crumbled and collapsed, because chimneys are not built to withstand the constant red-hot heat of flames. Here is a list of witnesses, with links to their entries, who claim that human corpses, which consist of 60-70% water, burned without fuel, all by themselves. If you want to read the technical refutation of such nonsense, read the respective entry. The next entry shows to some degree the results of the manipulative interrogation technique used by the already mentioned Polish judge Jan Zane. He interviewed most of the witnesses listed here, among them also about the efficiency of the Auschwitz cremation furnaces. The first entry here shows the value as established by wartime cremation log files kept in various camps, showing how these furnaces performed, and also on a variety of experiments conducted by experts prior to the war. This value was confirmed by 2 of the engineers who designed and built the Auschwitz furnaces, here highlighted in boldface, Kurt Prüfer and Kjell Schulze. They were both arrested by the NKVD and abducted to Moscow, where they were interrogated without Jens Zane's influence. While the NKVD pressured the engineers to confess their involvement in building gas chambers, they showed no interest in coercing any confession about the cremation furnace's capacity. Jens Zane's witnesses, however, all had the same tendency to vastly inflate the Auschwitz cremation capacity. Instead of correctly stating that the cremation of one body roughly took an hour, almost all witnesses claimed mere minutes, which is technically not just impossible, but utterly ludicrous. Reading the testimonies, it becomes clear that more or less all of them aimed at confirming with this the exaggerated Auschwitz death toll, which the Soviets and Poles had set to 4 million at war's end. Hence, what we see here is clear circumstantial evidence for the orchestration of an entire series of witness testimony to serve a political goal. The next entry I want to touch upon is the need for firewood and thus for lumberjacks to procure that wood, for the claimed open-air mass cremations, which are said to have been used at many a claimed crime scene. Interestingly, none of the witnesses who testified about these mass cremation events.
All right, we are live. We are live, and I welcome you, Mr. Rudolph. Welcome to the show.
Well, thank you very much for having me.
Absolutely, sir. It's a pleasure. I must say, I was watching you on the JP conference, and I thought, wow, this is a particularly knowledgeable guy. That was a fantastic presentation you did there. Very, very thorough, very thorough.
Yeah, I was a little bit surprised because I thought it was too superficial and too fleeting.
Really?
It tells you what I consider to be thorough. But I guess compared to what I was competing with, which I didn't know beforehand, it was evidently. So, I have very high standards that may show even things that for me are put together rather quickly. I was asked a relatively short notice to contribute, as everyone else had a longer time. So I decided relatively a few weeks before that only to actually submit something. And I was over the head in work back then. So I had to cut corners to put that together. Oh. But it turned out pretty good. Yeah. Well, thank you. You liked it.
Oh, yeah. No, I did. I did. It was it prompted me to get the book. So I have a copy. Yeah, highly recommended, everybody. Highly recommended.
Yes, yes. That's been the crowning achievement of my 35 years of work in that field of research and study. And that's quite a little bit of a background history, how I got to it. And normally you would say a Holocaust insight. Any kind of encyclopedia is a multi-person, multi-year project. And it was originally planned like that, but then I got stuck holding the baby pretty much all by myself. And I managed to pull it off within 5 months, basically, it was written. But this is because I have for 35 years done nothing else but studying the topic and amassing an awful lot of material. I published the 53 volumes of the Holocaust Handbook series, both English and German, and I have them retranslated and re-edited and issued in new editions over and over again. So I have also access to revisionist and skeptical periodicals that were dealing with this over the years, and I'm in charge of the only one that's currently still standing that's Inconvenient History. It's all on my computer. It's all in my head. So I have the knowledge. It was a historical singularity, as I call it. Mm-hmm. Everything came together that I had the knowledge and the time to do it. And then I had the incentive by a friend who was kind of kicking my ass to get the job done.
Well, that's good. So this work, as you just mentioned, it's a condensed understanding, I guess, of everything that's in that massive collection that is the Holocaust Handbook series. That's correct.
That's right. Yeah. That's right. The Holocaust Handbook series is a series of 53 volumes, most of them very detailed archival, some forensic studies. And each one of them stands by itself, addresses a certain subtopic of the overarching topic, the Holocaust. It's a kind of an umbrella term for a lot of things. And it's been difficult even for me, even though I've published them all. I've written quite a few of them, even though the most of them were written by Italian scholar Carlo Mattonio. Mm. When I was looking for certain information, I knew it's somewhere in one of these 53 volumes, and I have them as PDF on my computer, and I was looking for a certain reference, this and that, where is that? And I sometimes had to guess which one of the volumes it is in. There's sometimes various where it could be. Mm-hmm. And sometimes I had to just search through a number of them to find the thing that I was looking for. And that happened over the years over and over again. And sometimes for the same topic, I didn't write it down, or I can't remember where I wrote it down or where I published some reference. So I went through it again, searching. And at some point I was just so sick, even though I'm the person who is closest to the game, closest to this information, even I had trouble finding it sometimes, because these 53 volumes are not organized to make things easily findable, searchable. And so this friend of mine that I just mentioned, who made me, who stuck my nose to the grindstone, so to say, he had bought the series with the intention of wanting to use the information in there for a Holocaust discussion group he has on Gab. And when he got the volumes back then, I think we were at volume 48, 49 or something, he said, this is impossible. You have 6 running feet of books in your shelf and so much information. If you plan on reading it all, it takes you years to read it. By the time you're halfway through, you probably have already forgotten what you read to begin with. There's just no way of getting through this series containing all this information, let alone find anything that you knew, maybe remember to read somewhere. So for a person who has not published, republished, edited, re-edited, translated, retranslated this, it's even more difficult than for me. And for me, it was virtually impossible to find in an instant the information. So he said, we need to have an encyclopedia, some way of keywords that can be looked up, and a summary of information under this keyword with the reference exactly where to find the details. And he started actually doing this in his very layman way of approaching the issue, but realized it's just too much for him. And that's when at that phase when I met him and he said, you need to do something. This is an excellent source of information, but the information is absolutely inaccessible. Something needs to happen. I had already reserved the website and domain name that it is under now, holocaustencyclopedia.com, and had defined the project because I realized, yeah, that is a problem. But it was just too daunting a task. You know, if somebody told you, comes up to you, you have knowledge in some area and says, come on, write an encyclopedia. I want to have it next year.
Wow.
No, not going to happen.
Yeah.
You look at the ultimate encyclopedia on the Holocaust that's out there from mainstream. That was published at Yad Vashem in 1990. It's four volumes. And it has more than 200 contributors. I don't know how many years it took them to put it all together. Our encyclopedia has actually, in the introduction analysis of that mother of all mainstream Holocaust encyclopedias, it shows that, for the most part, it is a bloated hagiography that's having not really the essential information that any interested person has a right to expect in an encyclopedia, like all the evidence. What kind of evidence is this claim based on? And give you a summary of the evidence. Mainly it's anecdotal in nature. There's nothing in that encyclopedia. It's a lot of about heroes, martyrs, and so forth, but it's very little about the story itself and how it evolved and came to be and what it's based on. So to get this together, I had already stepping stones unknowingly done when I wrote my book Lectures on the Holocaust, which is volume 15 of that series. I tried to put as much information, essential information, in that book as I could. It covers all the aspects of it, and it has an index that index of subjects, and I use that subject index actually to start my list of keywords that need to be addressed in a Holocaust encyclopedia. And this gave me a jumpstart of some 400 terms. The encyclopedia now has almost 600. So not all of the 400 that are in the subject index of lectures on the Holocaust are in there, but there are many more that are not in the lectures. So it was then just a matter of discipline, of comparing it with other Holocaust encyclopedias of the mainstream. What do they cover? What did I forget? And to actually read what they wrote, and then complete our own list of things that need to be addressed. And while I could say that 90%, maybe 95% of the keywords I had, I could competently address with the research we had done. So it had by that point really be so comprehensive that we covered almost all bases. Almost all is not good enough. You need to have it all. You need to master the whole territory. Though there were always some gaps that I had to smarten myself up on. And but yeah, I worked from, as my friend said, he saw the light go on every morning at 4 o'clock in the morning, and the light turned off at 10 o'clock at night, from January of 2023 to June of 2023. That's the time it took to get everything in. Save a few entries that came later, but for the most part it was done. And then it was a matter of peer review and editing. And I had a very, very skilled friend, Tom Stalton, who has quite some knowledge in the area, has published in that field, and who has an academic background, excellent proofreader and copy editor, and also peer reviewer. Normally with that kind of massive amount, you would expect that again to last a long time, but it didn't. He was fascinated by it. He burned through it like a hot knife through butter. And the same with a number of people who were then double peer reviewing it. I said, okay, it takes me half a year to read this thing. And they were so mesmerized by it, riveted to the book, that within 6 weeks, one of them, after 6 weeks, he was through. It went much more smoothly, and easily, almost, I would say, in hindsight, than I would have expected. Mm. And I understand that if you have a massive project where 200 authors contribute, like the mainstream, you have a massive problem. You have a problem of motivation, of coordination, and of making things consistent, because every author has a different approach, and they may cover each other's territory without knowing, and then you'd have to change things around. And when this is your number one prestige project for which you're also being remunerated to some degree, it's a massive incentive to get it done. Normally, encyclopedias are projects of prestige for a scholar. You contribute certain entries to a encyclopedia, not because you get money out of it. They are never money makers. Right. You know, basically, specialty encyclopedias are bought by libraries and pretty much hardly anyone else. Maybe some experts in the fields, but that's it. They are not money makers. So you don't have a monetary incentive. The incentive is just that you will be listed as a contributing author, and that's good for your CV. That's good for your career. That's all there is to it. But then, like peer reviewing, you get the task, write an article, write a contribution. When other people are actually going to do that? They are involved in their own lives and their own academic activities, and this is just a sideshow. And then you need to kick ass and... as the lead editor to get everything in and then coordinate. It can be a nightmare, and then still you end up with something that isn't always consistent and that has so many different styles and different ways of looking at things that it becomes a problem. So from that point of view, it is actually easier to write an encyclopedia like that when you have only basically one person. It's all consistent and nothing repeats and everything gets done quickly. And you don't have to kick anyone's ass about your own. So ended up working out pretty well. But that doesn't mean I'm going to keep writing encyclopedias and things. Now, this is the one field that I master and where I feel competent and felt possible to do it. But I've already been approached by someone. Could I write an encyclopedia on that? Or this or the other topic in which I may have an interest in, mention my own point of views here and there, but no. Not going to happen.
This is absolutely a masterwork, and you have a very scientific and analytical mind, and I can tell that this rigor, the scientific training went into this. I don't think that many people could have done this to this level of precision that needs to be done, because, like, as you mentioned in passing, like, this is a topic that is so powerfully emotionally charged, I think, given everything that's happened with the decades of propaganda and the feelings about this, that to get anything wrong is to sabotage the credibility of the project. So that requires that absolute laser focus on backing up the information, making sure it's correct, having it double, triple checked. This is difficult to do. I don't think many people could do it. So hats off to you for managing to get it done. For the Holocaust handbooks, as you mentioned, these seem... Oh, where is it? Oh, there they are. It seems like such a massive tome that it really is just a sort of resource for people that want to have an academic approach to this topic, more than it's something people would read as a way to get introduced to it. You know what I mean? Like a passing interest wouldn't pick this up.
But right.
This actually does lend itself to that capability, because this is something that can be read through, and it really has an amazing glossary of terms to this, and character, you know, persons involved, and this is quite a resource, you know. And I figured I better get it given how much I talk about this topic. So again, my hat's off to you, and I really appreciate that you did it. Let me ask you though, actually, let me kind of use that as a pivot point. When you got involved in this, you didn't get involved from a political perspective, really, right, from what I understand. It was more from a scientific perspective where you, please, if you can, give me a little insight about that, because I don't get the impression that you came in this trying to advance politically motivated things so much as you discovered issues here with the mainstream story, right?
Yeah, well, I would say, first off, like it was Aristotle that said humans is a zoon politikon. So we are political beings, we are gregarious animals, and we always consider what's going around us and what's important. And from that general point of view, there is the metapolitical knowledge that this topic has massive importance and impact coming from, particularly in this case, a German background. This topic has massive impacts on Germany's self-understanding as a nation, as a people, as a cultural entity. And therefore, I was, of course, aware that it is that important. Beyond that, the importance of free speech, of addressing controversial topics, of toppling taboos that can become so powerful that they cripple a society, is nothing party political in nature, but it is metapolitical in general in nature. And when you look at it, yeah, there's more motivation than I just want to know the truth. If searching for the truth gets you executed, how many people would sacrifice themselves just for the sake of being curious when there is no reward or no importance or no necessity to find the truth? It is the one topic where retaliation, punishment, persecution, oppression is the most intense that there has been over since the Second World War in Western societies and is today. So there must be something more than just I want to know the truth. It is an understanding because, and I told that my mother, and eventually she actually, with all the opposition she put up against what I was doing, had to acknowledge it. Because the system wants to suppress that information with the most intensity of all information it wants to suppress, I am convinced that this is the most important topic to look at, because otherwise they wouldn't want you. Wouldn't want so hard to stop you. Whether my understanding of why it is important or not is correct and relevant, and whether you agree with it or not is secondary. Fact is, there's no other topic where the system wants to stop you and throw you in prison for than this one. And that's the proof that it is important, and that's the proof that it needs to be done, because as you say, on one hand, realize who you can't criticize to know who has the power in your country, but also realize which topic you can't question and scrutinize to know which topic is really the most important.
Yeah.
For whatever reasons. And there are many, and we can discuss those. So from that point of view, there's always a overlying political interest, knowing that it is politically important. But on my journey, I have encountered people who were national socialists, who were white nationalists, who were white supremacists, who were all the things you can come up with. That was their motivating factor. They realized this topic is very important for the mainstream to suppress their kind of view, their kind of approach, their kind of ideology. Mm-hmm. And they jumped on the bandwagon for that reason. And some of them realized down the road, it's not necessarily good for their cause if they, already being in trouble for whatever the cause of it is, hitch that problem on top of the problems they already have. So if you are, let's say, from a mainstream point of view, a white racist and a Holocaust denier, you're double in trouble. If you're only a white racist, you have only one trouble. So they realize, if I go into both of this, it's going to sink my boat even faster. So before you know it, they're gone again because they realize it's not a good idea. I have never been on board because of any of these topics, be it National Socialism, anti-Judaism, racism, nationalism, or whatever. I have a peripheral interest in these topics, more for their phenomenon than them being involved in any of it. But it's not my hobby horse, so to say. I'm after all that's been, all the bridges that have been burned behind me, and I've seen shifts in my own motivation. I look, for instance, at the fact that technically speaking, the German people in its original ethnic a composition is technically extinct today.
Wow.
When you look at the generation that gives birth of people in Germany right now, the ethnic Germans are minority, a small minority. So my fight for a survival of my own people, of my own culture, is lost. But I keep going. What never goes away is my incense of being denied the most basic human rights, of doubting, of searching for the truth, and of communicating what I have found out. This is constitutional to my humanity, to my human dignity. It's an inalienable right that's written down in the Charter of Human Rights of the United Nations, and that's being trampled into the ground, and I'm not taking it. You can see that in my personality. I had a physically abusive father. When I was a little boy, a toddler, he was trying to break my will with violence to the point where I was black and blue. My mother had me, even in the summertime, wear long clothes because she wanted to hide from teachers and so forth that I had all these black and blue marks. My father never broke my will. The more violent he was, the more unjust I felt treated, the more I dug in. And this is formative for my personality. And yeah, that has the same relationship I have with this government that wants to go after me. The more they push, the more I push back. Peacefully, intellectually, but I push back.
Yeah, that would be my question, is you just kind of answered it, is do you think that this kind of unfortunate circumstance growing up, do you think that that really kind of gave you the sort of iron will of defiance that, no, you won't break me for this? No, I have a right to do what I'm doing. What I'm doing is right, and you will not stop me from doing what is right. That's a hard character trait to develop. I think not many people develop this character trait.
Now, I don't know whether my father stole my will or whether it was, I mean, it must have been there already, or otherwise he would have broken it. Mm. So you come with a certain suit of personality traits into this world, and it is my conviction, and biological research, twin research has shown it, that our personality traits and character traits are to a large degree set and defined genetically and are immutable to a large degree. Well, we can discuss how much it is, but modern research shows that they put a percentage on it, 70, 80, 90%, whatever it is, it's just there. And I guess I came in with this into the world. And my experience of my father trying to break me and didn't manage to, whether that was a lesson I learned that I can get successfully with my hat through a concrete wall, I don't know. So here I am and trying to do the impossible. It's impossible to refute the Holocaust, and it's impossible to single-handedly write an encyclopedia that does exactly that. But to do the impossible, that's what I've done, and that's what I keep doing. And now the next step is to make the impossible, to have somehow create a paradigm shift that this news gets out in spite of all the censorship and book burning and dissident arrests that's going on here in this country now with Mahmoud Khalil, as you may know. He's not involved in anything critical on the Holocaust, as far as I know, but he's criticizing the same power structures oppressing his kind of people in the Middle East that is at the forefront of oppression in this country and in my native country, and who want to ram down their version of history down our throats in order to solidify their power position and their politics. And you can agree or disagree with the politics and the power structures, but I definitely disagree with anyone ramming down anything my throat without my consent.
I think you'd probably agree. It seems that in order to maintain the power structure, especially when it's not on a legitimate basis or not necessarily representative of the actual will of the people, if they want to have this kind of tyranny, they kind of have to have a rewriting of history, right? That if they were to tell exactly what happened as history, And of course, history is written by the winners, as who said that? Maybe Napoleon, but somebody said that. As that's the case, they're going to fight to have their version of it. I think it was Orwell or something that said something about that those who control the past control the present. Those who control the present control the future. And it seems that that is a critical element to this. I've argued that. I think that this is just as much about the Allies as it is about the Jews, because there's so many atrocities, as you're probably very well aware, that happened around World War II that were done by the Allies. And I think that with this story that they have, and that is absolutely forced, it eclipses so dramatically. It's so dramatic, I guess, that it eclipses some of the actual things that the Allies did wrong. I mean, like the Ryland Meadows camps, where they were shooting down the boats full of evacuating refugees, all this kind of stuff, it just kind of covered over by this grandiose Hollywood-esque crime that they say happened. And I think you're right about what it does to Germany and Austria. I think it just chokes the people out, and it's horrible. It's repressive everywhere, of course, but I think it's especially repressive there. And it's a brutal shame.
Yeah. Controlling history, and this is the topic I've focused on. That's the biggest taboo, and that's the biggest, as I call it, the sword and shield of Judaism and Zionism. They use it both for attack and defense. But it's, of course, it's not the only one. You look at just most recently the history of October 7th, what actually happened in Gaza with the Hamas incursion, and all the rest that followed after that. And that is happening to this day. The mass atrocities, mass slaughter, the humanitarian disaster that is designed and intentionally created, the dimension of it, getting downplayed or completely wiped off the memory as it happens already. So the writing of the history in a fake, twisted, distorted way to justify policies implemented now and in the near future is happening right in front of our eyes right there.
Absolutely.
So it's something that's been going on before the Second World War, and it's something that keeps going on. This is just the Holocaust itself is the most powerful, most taboo secured example of it that is giving them the sharpest sword to fight with. And that's why they overreact. I wouldn't even say overreact from their point of view. It's perfectly logical. That gives them the psychological tool to manipulate and control the masses in every which way. And that's why these things are happening. You know? What you see there, total devastation of Gaza, yeah, is justified at the end of the day with the Holocaust. In order to prevent that a Holocaust happens again, the Jews, the Zionists, the Israelis, whatever you want to do it, call it, who pursue such a policy, see the use of ultimate preventive violence to kill everyone in the way who could potentially in the future kill Jews, or who are feared by certain Jews, by traumatized Jews, self-traumatized Jews, to be their next murderer, their next Holocausters. So that's the justification to get rid of everyone that stays in the way. And I think it was Gilad Atzmon who said, you know, the Holocaust in the mainstream version that we are fed through all channels of media and society is used as the ultimate justification to rape, bomb, flatten, nuke anything that's in the way that could be perceived or construed to be a threat to Jewish interests, a threat to Jewish existence, to a threat to Jewish well-being. And it's the ultimate evil abuse, misuse of history for ulterior motives. What is that?
This is the damage map, the damage in Gaza. Map of the damage.
From which point? From what date?
Well, so this is provided by Bellingcat. Let's see what they say a date is for this. Oh, this is pretty early on, I believe, actually.
Yeah, because it doesn't look like total devastation yet, I would say. You need to look at it as it looks like now. It's probably much worse. Yeah, somebody said, and I believe it instantly, the ultimate symbol for destruction in the Second World War is Dresden when it comes to Germany. Of course, you can also take Hiroshima and Nagasaki, but when it comes to the European theory of war, it's Dresden. And somebody said that the amount of the tonnage per square mile dropped on Gaza is worse than what was dropped on Dresden.
Unbelievable.
Now, of course, Dresden has had only two or three, I think it was two air raids where the bombs were all dropped more or less at once, whereas Gaza has seen sustained bombardment over more than a year. So
they've also been denied stuff like water and medicine and just other sort of basic human rights stuff as well. So
it keeps happening.
Yeah. I think to even make matters worse, it's not a secret. I mean, even during the time of Dresden, they had media that could get out, film and newspapers and what have you, but it wasn't live streamed. You know, this is the first genocide, I think, that's been effectively live streamed out to the whole world. And the reaction to this has been, I think it's really telling as to the level of control they have. And I think a lot of people who might have not been ready to face this issue finally became ready to face the reality of Jewish power over the society based on the reactions to this. And maybe I should say the muffled reaction, the suppressed reaction to this, because it probably should have been far worse than, far more extreme of a pushback from the populace, given the horror show that they've put on for the whole world and the slaughter of these people.
And the mainstream media, for the most part, did not cover it. There was occasional footage of something exploding here or there. There was no proper coverage, considering the mayhem that was being caused there. Had it happened in any other part of the world, except for the I remember the Hutsi and Tutsi slaughter back in what was the mid-1990s, world media didn't pay too much attention to it, but it was generally acknowledged to have been a mass slaughter going on, and it was called as such. But in any other part of the world where something that like that would have happened, and the Western world wouldn't have had a vested interest in one side or the other, you could have expected intense coverage and a cry for a military intervention to stop it. I remember we had it in 1999, the Serbs going after the Kosovo Albanians on a much, much smaller scale than what we have now in Gaza. And NATO came together and declared war on Serbia and bombed them to the point where they quickly surrendered because they realized they can't sustain and win this, because Russia at that point was in disarray and Putin had nothing to say that yet. So there was nobody could help them. From that point of view, the proper reaction of the West should have been they should have declared war on Israel and bombed Israel.
Yeah.
Or at least, as they did in Ukraine, a big neighbor invades a small country and tries to smash it to pieces. That's the reason why the West supports Ukraine, not because they're a democracy. They were just as corrupt and before the war started as Russia was, you could say. There's a lot of problems with Ukraine and democracy. But that's beside the point. There's a lot of wrong with Western democracies, because if I were to go into any European country right now, I would be arrested. What kind of a democracy is it where dissidents get arrested and their book burns? That's a democracy at the end of the way. It's a word for a system where two wolves and a lamb decide what's for dinner. If you don't have guardrails of inalienable human rights that a democratic lynch mob is not allowed to violate, then that's what you have. It's a lynch mob. Democracy is a lynch mob, nothing else. You have the law railing them in, and if that's not there, that's what you have. So completely understandable and has some logic. We stand by a country, a small country, that is invaded by a bigger neighbor. For whatever reason, violence is not the solution. So we stand with a weak, invaded, violated victim. And following that logic, no matter what Hamas did, a few of them, and the small amount of casualties they caused, that's not a justification for full-fledged fledged invasion and complete destruction of an area. So following the same Ukraine logic, the West should have stood with Gaza and given them weapon to defend themselves. But no, the opposite happens, and the rhetoric's given because Israel is our ally and Israel is the only democracy in the Middle East, and they are threatened and they need to have the right to defend themselves. Where is the right of the Palestinians to defend themselves? They are the ones being attacked. We've got things completely upside down, but people can't think along that way. In a personal tragedy, around the turn of this past year, happened to sit in prison in a case that eventually ended like a charade by the prosecution dropping all the misdemeanor charges because the evidence was contradictory and was partly exonerating me, and all the witnesses didn't want to testify anymore. It was a big mess for the prosecution. They had to drop everything. But I still had to go through the prison experience. And the one guy I was sitting in a cell with, of Italian extraction by his ancestry, but a Eurocism by both for many generations already, I brought up the Gaza issue, and he said, well, this is a problem because they have so many terrorists in Gaza that it's like a cancer. Gaza is through and through filled with terrorists, like a body where a cancer has metastasized throughout. And the only way to fight that cancer is by cutting it all out. And if it is metastasized everywhere, they have to cut everything out. Of course, it's a bullshit from a medical point of view. If you have a metastasized cancer, it's inoperable and it's terminal, and you can't do anything anymore except for hospice and pain medication. But that's beside the point. This guy was, you know, one of the smarter part of the prison population, which is not normally the highest layer of society you find in there. Yeah. But even he was so taken by this propaganda that perceives anything countering or resisting or opposing Jewish or Israeli interest as terrorism automatically, where the Jews have all the right to preventively do anything to, quote unquote, cut it out.
Yeah.
Even to kill babies and children, because if you let them live after what they have experienced when they grow up, they will be terrorist fighters. And I have to agree, probably right at that point. They have no other chance, and they have no other way of retaining any way of any of their dignity but to sign up to fight, because that's the only path they've left over to die or fight. And that reminds me, when he said that, I told him, and on our side, my side, some people don't like it, but I say it repeatedly. This is kind of rhetoric that in some documents, I've read what Himmler said in some of his speeches. We can't let Jewish children and babies survive this Holocaust. It doesn't say Holocaust. It is about executions, partisan warfare in the East. You know, you can kill partisan men, and if you let their children live, they grow up to be partisan fighters in the next generation. So, to some degree, that may be correct. You can say all the Jews that survived the Second World War are now partisan fighters one way or another, or active fighters or warriors against whatever they perceive as enemies. So there is some logic to it, but it is an atrocious logic that says I have to kill everything that's in my way that could be perceived as an opponent in the future, potentially. Yeah. This is the kind of logic that is Old Testament in nature.
Rise and kill first.
I remember. Right. Yeah. And tooth for a tooth, an eye for an eye, yeah. And all the rest of it, which Gandhi once commented properly on it. An eye for an eye makes the whole world blind. This is not the way forward. This is not the way we can interact. Somebody needs to break the circle of violence.
Yeah.
And right now, it's not the Jewish state. It's not the Zionists who are anyway inclined to break the circle of violence. Quite to the contrary.
The response from America now seems very bizarre, but at the same time, kind of predictable, that they're basically trying to divvy it up and have... the Trump, I forget what they even called it. It's some kind of like Riviera kind of thing. Like they're trying to, like really, like you're just going to take these people's place, bulldoze their home that they've lived for what, thousands of years, and then be like, we're just going to do a real estate development here. The morality of that is pretty twisted. I can't compute that. But also the terrorism comment. I mean, that's overlooking, of course, that the whole modality of terrorism was developed by them. Menachem Begin was very proud of his development of the terrorist tactic. So a lot going on here, and it doesn't seem like they're handling it in a very good way at all. It seems entirely skewed towards the favors of the Israelis, and it's, you're right. It's kind of,
you know, atrocious. It depends on what your values are. I can't see, when you have extreme ethnocentric points of view of an ideology that wants to conquer, expand, and push other way, people out of the way. If you look at it from an Old Testament point of view, you look at the book of Joshua. I don't know whether you consider yourself a Christian, but if you read your Bible, but the book of Joshua, that's the claimed story of the conquest of the Holy Land by the chosen people after they've left Egypt and have been wandering through the desert for a while, and then they arrive there after Moses dies right at the verge of the Holy Land. And then Joshua is the next leader, and the book is basically one, if you want, it's a description of one genocide after another ordered by God. And if you read that at face value, no, we know from archaeological record that didn't happen. The whole story is kind of invented. It's a Jewish foundational myth, creational myth. But if you look at some of the fundamentalist Orthodox Jews, particular rabbis of the more radical extraction in Israel, how they justify religiously, ideologically justify what they're doing, particularly now in Gaza, that follows the book of Joshua. They have conquered a little bit of the Holy Land in 1948 when Palestine was divided. The Declaration of Independence of the State of Israel was instantly followed with a war of imperialism to expand that region and to ethnically cleanse it from as many of the indigenous Palestinian population as possible, with massacres like the one Deir Yassin is the most famous or infamous. So the creation of Israel started with genocide and imperialist expansion, but it doesn't stop there. The ideology is a much bigger Israel that goes from the sea to basically include all the Sinai Peninsula, goes to the Euphrates. So some of these radicals have ideas of taking Israel to 10 times the territory it occupies now and wipe out whatever is in the way, following the book of Joshua. And with the power grab they have and the domination in media, in finance, in politics in the Western world, they are in a position to implement that. And the most amazing thing is how they have been able to corrupt the surrounding Middle East countries. I don't even want to say Arab countries. Iran is the one exception, but Iran has multiple other problems of why Iran is supporting Russia in an aggressive war of expansion. It's a matter of whoever is my enemy is my friend. That's probably the policy that Iran is following there. Whether that's smart is a different issue. But all the other Arab countries, they sit there, don't do anything. Behind closed door, they may have opinions, but they don't voice anything. Nobody lifts a finger. Nobody threatens any. There's nothing going on. And I've seen that over the years when we revisionists tried to get anything going in the Middle East, be it Lebanon, Jordan, Egypt. There were attempts at certain activists to organize conferences and so forth. The local governments suppress Holocaust skepticism just as much as Western governments. throw people into prison, or sometimes even without due process, because these countries are not well known for having proper due process. So the dominance forced by financial extortion records. Many of these countries, when it comes to Egypt in particular, are deeply in debt and dependent on Western support. The governments are corrupted by financial leverage, basically. Yeah. So it is a sad show that with the way things are rigged, it is successful. I don't know how long and how more they can push that envelope until something snaps. And when it does snap, it can become really ugly. But I wonder, what is wrong? Well, for Israel, right or wrong, my country, we're going to expand and we're good at it and we control everything and we're getting away with everything. So as long as they have success, they are quote unquote right. Mm. Might is right. That's what the show is showing us here.
So I do wonder how they would manage to do this to some extent. I mean, I suppose the global war on terror and Iraq invasion was meant to soften this up for this, as well as what they did with Clinton and Obama with Syria. Some of these might be
the
harder.
Arab Spring.
Oh, yeah.
Arab Spring. Right. I mean, I can understand that some of these regimes were really oppressive, and I can understand that people want to rise up against it. But the whole thing starts with, if you look at any of the borders that have been drawn in the Middle East, they have nothing to do with ethnic states. They were drawn after the collapse of the Ottoman Empire by the colonial Western, basically by England and America, who carved up this entire region and drew borders as they pleased. You know, Syria is as well as Iraq. They are not sustainable countries. There are so many different ethnic groups. They don't get along with each other. If you were to redraw the map along ethnic entities, you get many more countries, and they could then be stable, but you will never be able to do that. You would have to carve up Turkey and Iran and Syria and Iraq to form a new Kurdistan, for instance. No, none of these countries would ever have it. So it's impossible. This region can never be stable. And I think it's been done so by design. Like in Africa, a lot of these borders have been drawn by colonial powers because either they didn't care or because they designed it in purpose, divide et impera, so the old principle. You cover up your enemy in a way that they fight amongst each other and can't unite against you, and then you can control them. And that's working splendidly from that point of view.
They're really great at that, right? Infiltrating and getting them to the two sides to antagonize, to fight each other. No, they've been fantastic about that. Well, fantastic for them.
Yeah.
Do you think that there's a chance that these countries get wise to what's going on here with this? Because I can't imagine they would like this. I mean, I can't imagine that. I think that they've got to be afraid of Israel by proxy of them using America as an attack dog against them, right?
Right now, what I'm seeing again is, as I mentioned, if a person has a political agenda that causes them a lot of trouble, like some right-winger or racist or nationalist or whatever in the West, also looking into Holocaust skepticism, and then he has two topics he gets in hot water. The Arab world or the Muslim world has a similar problem with Holocaust skepticism. If they strive to become independent of Western domination and Jewish imperialism or Zionist imperialism, then they're already in deep hot water because of the tremendous opposition they face. If they, in addition to that, bring in Holocaust skepticism, they're in double hot water. So for them, it's a double-edged sword to touch that sword and shield of Judaism and Zionism. And I see that right now when we're trying, or rather the publishing company that I sold the copyright of the encyclopedia to. It's a company in London. They are trying to get translations done in various languages. And one of the interesting markets would be having it in Arabic and in Farsi, that is to say Persian or Iranian, whatever you want to call it. Because particularly in Persia, in Iran, you would think after they have already organized back in 2006 a Holocaust revisionist conference that there would be an open mind in this area. And the feedback that my publisher has gotten is that in almost every language, we have found takers. I think right now, all major European languages are on board and translations are being prepared. So we got Portuguese, Spanish, Italian, Greek even, Swedish, French, German, Russian, Polish. So all over the landscape, but not Arabic and not Farsi. Can't find a taker. As a matter of fact, we had a publishing company interest showing an interest initially in Lebanon. And then Beirut got bombed in the course of the Israeli reaction to October 7th. And this communication went to completely dead. It may be that the headquarters of that publishing company was targeted and was destroyed, or that anything is in disarray in this country. Anyway, I see fear. I see a lack of insight, of understanding of the importance of that topic in the Arab world, and the few contacts that I had, for what it's worth, it's indicated to me that they see that as a political tool rather than a scientific scholarly field of research. You've seen that with the Mahmoud Ahmadinejad conference that was staged in 2006 in Tehran. That was primarily a political approach. They did that to tick off the West and to you see the what kind of contributions there were. Most of them were more political than historical in nature. And Arabs that I've met have thought, well, Holocaust revisionism is a way of skewing history, not making it confirm with the facts and the archival record, but of skewing and distorting history in order to piss off the Jews. And when I try to tell them we have so much support from evidence that what we're doing is not skewing, we are unskewing. We are actually setting the record straight, not fudging the record in order to piss off the Jew. So they are sometimes amazed to realize, wait, you're saying you're not lying in order to annoy the Jews, but you're actually telling the truth. Right. So there's a warped mindset, Arabic mindset, that thinks the revisionists are wrong. 6 million did die, gas chambers did happen, and some of them say, hopefully that did happen, because they at this point, so many of them say, well, you know, the only solution to that problem is send all the Jews to the gas chambers, because otherwise we'll never have peace. They need to get gotten rid of somehow. And if it's gas chambers, what it takes, let's do it. That goes along with the Israeli fear that every person who is subjected to their kind of state terrorism ends up being a quote-unquote terrorist. And one person's terrorist is the other person's freedom fighter.
Right.
That there is a growing movement, a grassroots movement, not in any way in the establishment and the political sphere, to have a less and less compromising, less and less benevolent attitude toward anything Jewish. So there's something indeed growing on the grassroots level that says, if the Holocaust wasn't true, it's too bad, let's make it true now. This is the danger that the Jews put themselves in. They have grabbed this little piece of desert and have implemented and keep implementing policies that pisses off hundreds of millions of people that are surrounded by. And if they keep pushing it, as I mentioned earlier, at some point they'll snap. And they're not going to use gas chambers. The Jews can have as many nukes as they want in Israel. There are going to be enough Arabs left over after the nukes that were still many enough, and the nukes will backfire on Israel itself. You can't nuke your neighbors and be unaffected by all the radioactivity that you throw left and right. So at the end, it's a Samson option. And at some point, the Arabs don't give a rat's ass anymore. We'll gladly sacrifice 200 million of us to get rid of these 6 million. If that's what it takes, that's what we'll do. That's unfortunately what this is headed to. And I was saying as much at a bat mitzvah of a friend of mine, of a cousin of a friend of mine, who is the daughter of a minister for Jews of Jesus. I used to have a Jewish girlfriend. Anyway, for a short period of time. And she went to that bat mitzvah with me, and we were at the dinner table. It was in summer 2003, during just after the Iraq War. The rising Iraqi insurgent movement, whatever you want to call it, and the American reaction toward it. And a discussion was coming up after the bat mitzvah, along a lunch outdoors at a long table. And my girlfriend's father, I think it was at the end of the table, one end of the table, and I was sitting at the other. And they were saying something, well, these Arabs, they're all terrorists. We should get rid of them by bombing them into oblivion, all of them.
Wow.
So there was an exterminationist attitude toward anything standing in the way of Israel and the Jews. Nothing new. I mean, we see it play out now. And that's when I said, you know, you grab this little piece of land thinking it's yours because some old writing from 2,000 years, 3,000 years ago says so. And that writing was written by people, not by God, because all books on planet Earth are written by people. And then you implement a policy that antagonizes everyone to the point where at some point they'll just overrun you. And if they have so many casualties, they don't give a rat's ass. You are going to be in a position where the only – it's worse than the situation you have been in 1939, 1940 in Germany. You could leave there. Many of you did leave. Once it's getting hot there – you have one escape route that's a short coastline at the Mediterranean, and there's not a lot of you that will be able to leave. Now, airports shut down very quickly after some strikes, no air traffic anymore, and you're caught. You're all trapped.
And the only way. Very short-sighted, right?
Yeah. The only solution to that problem is, and I told that to that guy across the table. Every single one of them was a Jew. I was the only Gentile there. The solution to that is get the hell out of there and go back to where you came from.
Yeah.
It's a shocking statement after he had just said to nuke or to kill all the Arabs and bombing them in the Bolivia. Dead silence at the table.
Wow.
They all looked at me because I had clearly said, you get out to where you came from. So I was not including me. I wasn't saying we. And then the father said, after a silence of 5 seconds, 10 seconds or so, you're right. And then we went back to our lunch. I was completely shocked. Because when I said this, I thought I had it coming because they were diehard Zionists and staunch Israel supporters. But after my short speech about you need to get the hell out of there and get back to where you came from before you have it coming, he says just, you're right. If they think a little bit about their strategic situation they put themselves in and they make it worse with every bomb they throw, they need to come to that very simple conclusion. You're right. You need to get the hell out of there and go back to where you came from. As long as the countries where you came from still want to have you. Because if you keep pushing it too far, that may flip too. Particularly in Europe, when you look at the population dynamics there, in 50 years, Europe will be majority Muslim.
Yeah.
And that point, Europe will flip. And where are you going back to then?
No, absolutely. It seems like this massive feedback mechanism with them where they just keep pushing it and it keeps getting pushed back by the people they're pushing on. And it's just back and forth and back and forth through time. and they don't seem to be able to disconnect and break the cycle of this. I think it's probably wired into this whole history that they cling to so tightly, but they refuse to ever let a grudge go. And you're right, it's pushing them into a situation where there's not going to be anywhere to go to. This whole thing that they've sponsored with all this mass migration stuff, this has just made it so that everywhere is inhospitable to them. I think they got a taste of it following this October 7th response, where all of a sudden they're finding that they're getting hostility in Australia and in Europe and in America. And, well, I mean, if you look at who was the leadership of most of these Palestine protests, well, it was mostly Arab people. And the irony being, of course, that their NGOs very vigorously advocated for this importation of Arab peoples in the first place. So they keep sort of shooting themselves in the foot. And honestly,
they keep slaughtering the cows that they want to milk and that they have have been milking for the past,
Yeah. Well, no, you're right. And I mean, even that for poor Germany, I mean, Germany's paid how many billions in reparations every year? I mean, what is this?
I'm not too much focused on the financial aspect. I have looked into it. I mean, it's roughly now stands at roughly $100 billion. But if you look at what Germans spend every year abroad, just abroad, they are the world champions and have been for decades in going on vacation abroad. What Germans spend every year on vacation abroad amounts to, I can't remember, anyways, it's $40, $50 billion every year. Okay. Ongoing for 50, 60 years. They started the abroad vacation mania, I would say, national socialism there, the Kraftdurchfreude cruise lining. So they were making vacations possible for the lower and middle class, and it has caught on, and it's been a sport, a competition in Germany to brag about going abroad on vacation, 2 weeks here, 3 weeks there. And Germans get a lot of vacation from work, so you start your work life with 4 weeks vacation and you end with 6, 7, 8 weeks or whatever at the end of your career, and people go mostly abroad. So they have the money to burn individually every year. That amounts to almost half of what they have paid in 80 years to the state of Israel or to Jewish individuals or to anyone persecuted, presumably persecuted by National Socialism. So I would say they can afford it. This is not breaking the bank by far, and there's no issue. And there has been persecution. A lot of it has been paid to people who indeed survived and who had been in forced labor camps and concentration camps and so forth. I do not want to deny those people a restitution of lost career chances, lost property, and suffering endured. That's all right. I would say, but everyone who had suffered some injustice during that war should be getting reparations, not just the Germans paying everyone else, but if the Germans had suffered, they should get some restitution too. Because that's never on the table. But let's not talk about money. That's really not the issue. The issue is more of a political nature of are the German people allowed to define their own, to research and write their own history without impediment, without taboos, without threats of punishment and incarceration? Are they allowed to develop their own culture and ethnicity like any Amazon tribe and Papua New Guinea tribe is allowed to have their own ethnic and cultural identity? And that's true for anyone else, for that matter. And the answer to that all is clearly no, they don't. So, and I experienced that very early on. Now, when it comes back to the Jews, the way they react is because they're traumatized. If you look at how Jews are raised, and particularly Israeli Jews are raised from early childhood on, being dragged through Holocaust education over and over again, being dragged into concentration camps, into camps where they are said to have been homicidal gas chambers. And you see they walk there through with the Israeli flags on their visits, and they visibly re-experience, reenact the claimed mass slaughter in these chemical slaughterhouses. And this is a kind of brainwashing, indoctrination, inculcation of a trauma that is said to have been really experienced by their grandparents or great-grandparents' generation. These people are made to virtually suffer this over and over again. They're getting traumatized and re-traumatized. Normally, and I know that from my own history, I have had my own trauma. I can relate to Jewish persecution trauma. I was offended in very early years before my own experience when Jews of German extraction or of any extraction who had gone through the persecution of the Third Reich, whatever that means in terms, but there was persecution, of course, that they were offended to hear the German language.
Wow.
Now, any American patriot who hears that somebody is offended to hear the English language would be himself offended. Why would you be offended by my natural language? I've done nothing wrong.
Yeah.
You know, I was offended by people being offended by the German language. I'm at the point now, as you hear me talk, I'm completely fluent in English, and this is not my primary language. And I have experienced incarceration, persecution, and destruction of my civil life and my career and so forth to a degree that many Jews experienced in the Third Reich. Again, also by a German government, by a German society, which in the vast majority of its members, at least externally, agrees with that kind of persecution because they perceive me as some evil person.
No.
If I nowadays hear someone speak German, and it's not a family member that I feel safe around, I have the same subconscious reaction of feeling offended, feeling threatened, not wanting to be around these people. It's my own people. I'm German, but I have that reaction because of my experience. So I can completely relate what it means to be traumatized. Now, here's my reaction to this trauma. And that's the only one that can lead to healing, is not wallow in it. Try to forget, try to normalize your life, try to get to a place where you are comfortable, where you're familiar with your surroundings and the people, where you feel safe, and then avoid constantly reliving, remembering, regurgitating what traumatized you. What is happening with the Holocaust and the Jews is the exact opposite: re-traumatization. They are being exposed to these horror stories, and according to my research, most of it exaggerated and invented without them knowing it, because they believe that themselves, their teachers believe it. It has been so deeply entrenched now that there are very few that look through it and realize this can't be true. Traumatization works only if you believe in what you're seeing. So entire generations, and the second and the third generation now, is getting traumatized and re-traumatized to the point where it is inevitable that they have this adverse reaction against anything that they were taught and traumatized with is a threat, particularly anything German. But in general, not just the Germans did it, the Ukrainians helped, the Poles helped, the French helped, in Europe almost everyone helped, because they were in one way or another, one layer or section of their society or another, collaborating, cooperating with the Germans, whether voluntarily or not, but cooperation was there to some degree. So that's then the entire European attitude. Anything European is a threat. Anything that is a threat, perceived as a threat, and then is the entire Arab world, Palestine, they have this trauma reaction, and then the paranoia that any of these people could do again what I was made believe happened to my great-grandparent generation. The paranoia that I myself am actually officially diagnosed with. I had to go through psychiatric evaluation when we adopted my ex-wife, and I adopted two children in 2013. And there was a lawyer who found out about my background and screamed bloody murder, wanted the kids removed after they had already been placed with us. And I had to eventually go through the psychiatric assessment of whether I would be able to be a good father to these children. And what I was diagnosed with, that I have to some degree of paranoia, persecution paranoia, that I distrust authorities and that I feel persecuted. Now, had this psychiatrist actually known what I have been through with all the laws that governments have broken and violated in order to throw me into prison, to deport me, and they would probably have understood that this is not without reason. It's actually justified. And if you know my background, to see how until recently I have lived a rather normal life psychologically and emotionally, you would be amazed how little paranoia there was.
Yeah.
Because I avoid re-traumatizing myself. Things have happened. As I mentioned, I was in prison shortly. It happened. It all dissolved and resolved nicely for me at the end. But it was, again, a traumatic experience, another one that has led me now to a point that I'm no more paranoid than anything. This Mahmoud Khalil case particularly puts me on edge. He's a green card holder. I am. 20 years ago, I was deported with an American wife with a small baby. So I know exactly what Mahmoud Khalil is going through, and I feel myself personally threatened now. And I get paranoid. Out in front, any neighbor closes a car door, and I go and look whether it's immigration services coming to my door.
Wow.
Even though I have no reason, because none of the things that are going on right now have anything to do with it, with me. But what happened to me in the past was considered unthinkable before it happened, and it happened still. So right now, it's unthinkable that it come for me, because I'm not part of these partly violent pro-Hamas, pro-Palestine demonstrations and this and that. So I should be safe. But who can tell? I've seen water flow up the hill. I've seen horses vomit, and I've seen shit hit the fan in my life so many times. And I can understand when you go through this kind of traumatization and you have wars happening at your doorstep and you have terrorist attacks did happen in Israel. And this gets emphasized over and over again in Israeli society that these Jews, Zionists and whatever, are traumatized, are paranoid, and they get paranoid to the point where they think, with all they're told and taught and traumatized with, that any Gentile hiding under any rock could just suddenly jump up and kill you. And the only way to make you safe from it by killing any Gentile that's in your way. The way out is to stop traumatizing yourself.
Yeah.
Salvation for the Jews and for mankind lies in Holocaust truth. Figure out that you have been lied to. At least stop traumatizing, even if it were all true, stop traumatizing your children in forgetting. Never forget is wrong. Never forget, always remember is the recipe for eternal disaster, eternal traumatization, eternal paranoia, eternal genocidal attitude to everyone else. This genocidal paranoia is created by Holocaust education. Jews, their salvation lies in Holocaust skepticism, in liberation of this gas chamber trauma. It didn't happen. Fortunately, it didn't happen. There is a door out of this disaster of complete trauma, followed by complete paranoia, followed by one genocide after another. And that is the Holocaust Encyclopedia.
It's very interesting, because I don't think they realize how much of a relief it should be to them to find out that no, you were not, your ancestors were not fumigated to death. Like, that's not what happened.
Right.
And that this should be a great relief. This should be a great, wow, okay, like the world is not as evil as I've been led to think it is, kind of thing. And they don't seem to interpret it that way. They seem to interpret it as a further threat. And like you mentioned about the political use of it in the Arab countries, they seem to think that you're, that, well, not just you, but we're all lying about this, that we have a some kind of secret agenda to trick them into thinking that it didn't happen when it really did happen. And I don't understand that. I don't understand what the claim is.
Well, I can understand. There are always many angles to it. And I can understand when you think the mainstream way. A Holocaust denier, in their point of view, is a person who denies the Jews their experience of persecution, which is already incorrect. Holocaust denial doesn't mean denial of persecution. Holocaust skepticism questions certain aspect of what happened. There's no doubt that there was persecution. But the aim, the perceived aim and motivation of Holocaust skeptics and deniers, which is not necessarily the same thing, you know, is to portray the Jews as some evil conspirators who created that lie or myth or hoax or whatever you want to call it, in order to portray them as ultimate evil people to manipulate and control the world. And these people being so evil by constructing and creating that hoax for control purposes that they need ultimate punishment. And I can see that is a danger, that this Holocaust skepticism could be used and abused by people to go exactly down that road saying, well, okay, so the Holocaust is a lie. This is a simplification that's already not true. The Holocaust is an umbrella term. You can't say that it is a lie because there's no such thing as a monolithic it, the Holocaust. It's such a complex topic with so many events and locations and over so many period of so many years in the entire continent. So the term Holocaust denial and Holocaust lie makes no sense as such. But aside from that, the question really is that we also not only need to understand that it is distorted, misrepresented, partly invented, certain aspects of it, but we also need to know who's done it. That's a very important question. And I actually, for many years, I've stayed away from it, but because I feared the answer could indeed be that the main moving powers behind creating that myth were Jewish and Zionist in nature. And this can backfire by then again helping to traumatize Jews. And you know, we get rid of the gas chambers in history, but then we get Jews as conspirators of creating this lie. So you're swapping one evil thing with another. Not a good thing. Now, I have, while I was putting together the Holocaust Encyclopedia, I have gained insight into how the myth actually evolved to such a degree as I didn't have myself before. Having a lot of knowledge doesn't really mean you have the oversight over the topic. You really, I would say, it's a huge forest and you can get lost in it and you see a lot of trees and branches and leaves, but you don't see the overall forest, the overall structure and how it's built and kept together. Writing an encyclopedia has put me in a position where I can actually do that and has shown me how this myth of gas chambers, and that's the core of the Holocaust that is questioned and basically refuted with that. There were mass executions in the East. We can talk about motivations, organization.
Those are partisan killings, though, degree. Right? The executions in the East. Gruppen.
Yes. Right. Yes. So they happened, but if you look in the encyclopedia, the evidential situation is a mixed bag there. We don't exactly know to what degree and the exact numbers and motivation. There almost certainly was not a order from high up to make it systematically. But it's all in the context of the cruelty of the war in the East where things like that happen. When we're talking about what is really at question, it's the homicidal gas chamber issue. And while I was writing it, I came to understand how this myth formed. And I've published my own book on that, where I actually extracted this information, which is scattered throughout the encyclopedia, and put it together and linked it so people can actually see it. If you go to the website armreg.co.uk, can go in the Holocaust Encyclopedia. It says their bookstore. That was actually would have been the short link to it.
Sorry, say again.
Armreg, like the arm, and then reg.co.uk.
Oh, there it is. That's a different. That's a different arm.
Go back to the encyclopedia. It has a bookstore link on there. That brings you straight to it. Okay. Bookstore.
Bookstore.
Right. And these on there, scroll a little down. A little farther, you get to the point where you have Nazi gas chambers, the root of the story up there. You know, you just passed it.
Oh, there it is.
Up there on the right. Yes. This book was, we just put the second edition, corrected edition out in January. That gives you a short summary of how that story evolved. And interestingly, there is something that could be found out in detail only after the collapse of the Soviet Eastern Bloc, because many of the archives were not accessible to most historians, particularly not to independent Western historians. And they became accessible then. And Kalamatonia has done a formidable job to track down the history of how these narratives formed about every single one of the camps. We're talking about basically six camps where this mass extermination in homicidal gas chamber is said to have happened. That's alphabetically Auschwitz, Belzec, Chemno, Majdanek, Sobibor, and Treblinka. Mm-hmm. And all of them were located in what is today Poland. And so you start 1941, 1942, when you have the first messages by the Polish underground being circulated, being sent to London and being published there. And you see a completely inconsistent, incoherent story, wild stories being told about this camp and that, and what murder methods. They're all over the place. So it's clear there's not much coordination and much intelligence in it. There's just rumor mongering and black propaganda and all kinds of things going on. Toward the end of the war, the Soviets move in and they put the big propaganda loudspeakers, so to say, on this whole campaign and trumpet it out, particularly then in the International Military Tribunal in Nuremberg. But still, the story is very inconsistent, and particularly if you look at the story, how it's told today by the mainstream, has at times very little to do with what was told at Nuremberg. So how do we get from this inconsistent, incoherent, chaotic stories of the wartime and immediate post-war period to what we have today, where you have a relatively good consistency and coherence, and all witnesses more or less telling the same story about each camp? And you look in the record, and you find that right after the war, the Soviets hand over things to the newly installed Polish Stalinist authorities, and the judiciary there prepares show trials for several of the camps, Majdanek, Auschwitz, and Treblinka indirectly with the governor of that district, the Warsaw district. And you find out that there are Polish investigative judges. One of them, Zdzisław Łukaszkiewicz, was doing research on Treblinka, Sobibor, and Majdanek. Jan Zayn was doing Auschwitz, and Władysław Bednarz for Chełmno. And we have a historian dealing with Belzec, Eugenius Freud. So we have four people, Polish, none of them Jewish. They take the records that were existing then, the reports from the underground and so forth during the war, and then they investigate, they interrogate witnesses that had survived the camps and claimed they had experienced, and then they create something out of it. if you look at the witness statements, completely chaotic, everything goes, no coordination, no consistency, almost all of them when it comes to the claimed pure extermination camps. So people who have no Belzec and Treblinka are Jewish, because that was camps where Jews were deported to. And then what happened to them there is then a question. Whereas when it comes to Majdanek and Auschwitz, you have a mixed bag of Jewish and non-Jewish witnesses. But for the vast majority, the most witnesses we have, because they were the target number one minority scapegoated by the National Socialists, are Jews. But there is no coordination. There is no consistency. There is no conspiracy, if you wish. It's just anything goes in the moment where Germany collapses. I mean, everyone is willing, or not everyone, but a lot of people are willing to make all kinds of wild claims. The Polish judges go in there with a machete, a hacksaw, whatever you want to call it, and clean house. They throw everything out that doesn't make sense and create a narrative. Treblinka based basically only on one witness account, and they skew it a little bit. But the witness account we can trace back, he has plagiarized it from a report of the resistance from 1942. And in an earlier testimony, he had made a completely different statement, which clearly shows he has no clue what he's telling. It's not his own experience. He has plagiarized it. That is taken and then defined as that's what happened in Treblinka. We throw everything else out. Then this judge copies it over to Sobibor one-on-one. Because all the witnesses in Sobibor tell a completely different story. Somehow they coordinated amongst each other, invented a wild story about collapsing floors and trains running underneath, and completely rejected nowadays. The judge throws this completely out, copies over from Treblinka, and then the historian who writes the story of Belzec basically copies it over to Belzec, rejects the witness accounts he has there. So you see, there is a newly installed Polish judiciary and one historian who create that account. Whether they have been given instructions on exactly how to do that or not is not clear, at least not yet. Whether they were in upper levels of the newly installed authorities or even from Moscow, any Jewish influence that was giving instruction, we don't know. But from what we can see at the base of who was doing the job, who's done it, who has created these stories out of old cloth or out of, you know, just picking one randomly, they were non-Jewish, Polish, Stalinist judges for the most part.
That was my understanding too. It's amazing because I think it came out in the Zundel trial, right, where they had deliberately thrown out the testimonies that didn't jive with the story that they wanted to tell, right? There was a number of Jewish witnesses that said, no, that's not really what happened. Yeah, they worked us in these camps and that was all they told what happened, but they didn't, they were talking about, you know, the secret showers and gassings and...
Well, the issue, when you look at Treblinka, they had murder by vacuum, murder by steam, murder by electrocution, murder by mobile gas chambers that would roll over the mass graves, murder by delayed action gas that would allow the victims to walk through the mass graves and fall dead only there, murder by a death bridge, having people jump off the death bridge. I think for Belzec, they had murder by shit. So Jews had to defecate on the heads of their fellow Jews to make them suffocate. There is, everything goes, murder by axe, by machine
electric
gun.
Masturbation machines.
Yeah, electrocution. Everything goes.
It's crazy.
How do you make a consistent story out of this? Complete chaos. Witness anarchy. And it was done. We're just taking one witness account that sounded most credible or at least possible and throw everything out. So there was no lack of extermination claims. It was just a lack of consistency and coherence. And that was created. So there is no Jewish conspiracy there. And if you look at when the organized jury, when particularly the State of Israel chimed in consistently, systematically, with state effort, that was, according to what I perceive, only in 1961 with the Eichmann trial in Israel. That's when the story had already been cast in stone and solidified, and they just picked it up from there and ran with it. Now, of course, they were using it Jewish organizations were using Holocaust claims to further their agenda earlier. They were using Holocaust claims already at the end of the 19th century, prior to the First World War. So the Holocaust and 6 million suffering and dying Jews, this claim is way older than the Second World War. Right. It was picked up again right before the Second World War, during the Second World War, after. So this is not a new story. The Jewish obsession with six is particularly known. It starts with a six-pointed star and it goes through the whole society. The issue is not that they weren't keen on using this kind of propaganda for their own purposes. The issue here is who developed the story, rammed it down the world's throats, historians' throats, and that was the Polish Stalinist post-war attempt of solidifying their propagandistic dominance over Germany. Because you need to realize, if you look at a map, when you look at what Poland looks like, the borders of Poland today, and you compare that with the borders of Germany in 1914, before the First World War, you see that half of the territory, roughly half of the territory of what is today Poland, used to be German territory.
Right.
Now, Germany lost a little bit of it after the First World War, but the majority of it was lost after the Second World War, and there was a massive ethnic cleansing going on. So the Poles had a massive interest of portraying the Germans as the ultimate evil, as genocidal maniac who deserved all kinds of punishment, who had to put up with their own ethnic cleansing and genocide as justified punishment for the genocide they had committed. So establishing this genocide was in the vital interest of post-war Stalinist Poland. The original nationalist government that had gone into London exile was opposed to this method, massive ethnic cleansing and land grab, but they were booted out once Stalin had invaded and occupied Poland and put its communist government in there. And Stalin had a massive interest in pitting Germans against Poles eternally by committing this massive ethnic cleansing, which he hoped would lead to eternal strife and conflict between Germany and Poland, so that these two countries can't gang up against Russia. There's always an interest of Russia to make sure that Europe does not unite so they can keep chomping away on the Baltic state, on Finland, on Ukraine. This is something that, you know, Ukraine conflict looks like for younger generations, it looks like something that comes out of the blue. But no, Russia has invaded and tried to occupy Ukraine for so many times. And one of the main reasons there were the outbreak of the First World War was Russia's expansionism into the Balkans. So that's been something that's going on for centuries, and that will probably keep going on if Russia doesn't turn around and become a more mature member of the human family. But this is beside the point. So all this has to do also with the Cold War that started there, where the East kept using Nazi propaganda. Let me rephrase that. Propaganda portraying the West as successors or endorsers of remnants of Nazism and fascism. So there were the Soviets portrayed themselves as liberators, as anti-fascists, ultimate anti-fascists. And with the Cold War conflict, they had to portray the enemies in the West as something that was not anti-fascist. So they must be fascist or supportive of fascism. And to portray Germany, particularly West Germany, as a successor state that were in historical continuance of the Nazi regime, which was ultimately evil because of gas chambers and the Holocaust.
Let me ask,
is a part of Cold War propaganda. So all you see there, Poland's national interest because of the land grab and the Cold War conflict, has nothing to do with Jews.
But let me ask though, was there actually a difference to the attitude of this information when Germany was split between East and West, or was it still a unified attitude? I would imagine, given what you just mentioned about how the origins of this, maybe the Eastern communist-controlled part was there any difference, or was it still kind of a unified attitude?
Not really. They saw themselves as in the position they had to prove to the world that they had learned and were making good as much as they could, and were bowing to demands of persecuting or prosecuting everyone that was somehow suspected of having committed violent crimes under National Socialism. There was not much of a difference. The East had a slightly more show trial approach to the trials they did stage than the West. But show trials that were all the same on both sides of the Iron Curtain, because it was politically not acceptable for these courts to question the general veracity of the narrative that was basically coming out of Poland. Poland had in the 1940s, late 1940s, late 1950s actually, had established its own. No, in late 40s, 46, I think, they established its own periodical that was focusing only on publishing reports and papers that were making these Holocaust and general. It was called the Bulletin of the National Commission for the Investigation of German Crimes in Occupied Poland. That was the roughly the title of that magazine, and it was publishing articles initially in Polish, and then they started in the late 90s to issue the Auschwitz Hefte and the Gazeta on Auschwitz, and that was focused on creating the Auschwitz narrative, and they had a Polish edition of that magazine and a German edition at a time when speaking German in Poland was considered a crime. They had still a strong German minority because they did not ethnically cleanse everyone, particularly in Upper Silesia. They had to keep the strong German minority, otherwise they couldn't have run the industries there, so they kept them. But they wanted to polonize them by force, and therefore they kind of declared it a crime in Poland to speak German for the first 2 decades after the war or so. But they published a German magazine. There was no market in Poland for it. But it was specifically targeted for the German, West German judiciary, particularly with the upcoming Auschwitz trial in Frankfurt, to publish everything they were doing in the German language so the German judiciary could read it, and the prosecution would and did introduce that. And that was taken at face value of what the Polish Stalinist communist government was producing, was taken at face value by West German governments, and the defense was basically not allowed to challenge it, and they didn't have the means of actually challenging it, because it would have required getting access to the archives, which became really freely accessible only after the collapse of the Eastern Bloc.
So this makes it a by default uneven playing field, where it's rigged towards it's solving for Holocaust basically, and this is pretty terrible. I've heard that you actually can't, if you were accused of Holocaust denial in Germany, you're not able to produce any evidence to support your claims that this or the other event didn't happen. That's not basically, the truth is not a defense. That's an incredible and quite tyrannical dynamic to live under, where the truth cannot be presented as a defense for something you're accused of. That's insane.
The German penal system, that requires its own podcast, is a very peculiar one. In the 1970s, they got rid of the defense's right to introduce evidence. So in Germany, the prosecution and the judges can introduce evidence. The defense cannot. How can you defend a defendant if you cannot introduce evidence?
That's insane.
Yeah. I've never seen any country where it's they have, of course, both sides in a trial, prosecution and defense, can motion the judge to do certain things. So the defense has to motion the judge to introduce evidence. But the judge can say, kiss my ass, you know, I'm not doing shit. And he has a long list of reasons why he can reject evidence, and he has even now a list where he has to reject evidence. And when it comes to these cases of historical dispute, you are on trial for denying or minimizing, trivializing, justifying whatever event is claimed in history. That's why you're on trial. Now, if you are trying to prove that you're right with your opinion, you, by doing so, commit the very crime again for which you are on trial. Therefore, logic demands that introducing evidence which aims at supporting your views, aims at challenging the mainstream narrative, is per se a crime. So you motion the judge to introduce it because the defense has no right to do anything. It just motion it. When you motion the judge to introduce evidence like that, you make yourself punishable under the law. And that includes the defense lawyer. So in Germany, defense lawyers have been, in one case, actually, defense lawyer tried to introduce me as an expert witness on forensic studies as I had conducted it, which got me in this entire topic. And he was then prosecuted and sentenced for having motioned the judge to introduce him as an expert witness. Furthermore, you know, trials are public. That is a means of making sure that the government or the judiciary doesn't do any shenanigans behind closed doors. So public accessibility to trials is an important instrument in a state under the rule of law. However, the German judiciary, or the legislative branch, I should say, in this case, and the judiciary has gone along with it, has made sure that even if a trial is public, the public will not ever find out what's going on. And they do it the following way. They have two instruments to do that. If in a case like this, where anything politically controversial is being discussed, that in itself could be considered a crime, the judge can and will, and has done in my case too, order the defense lawyers to remain silent. They are not allowed to speak anymore. Because, you know, you may not be able to introduce evidence. You may not be able to succeed with your motion to have the judge introduce evidence, but you still can read into the record all the evidence you have before you file it as a motion. This way you can tell the public all the evidence we have, that they realize what is being suppressed here. Okay?
Wow.
But if you do that, you use a public stage to commit a crime by challenging the mainstream narrative. So they added a law because of my appearances and my in court and lawyers reading what I would have to have said had they ever accepted. I was never accepted, of course. Reading it into publicly before filing the motion, they introduced a law in 93, I think, that allows them to muzzle defense lawyer. Happened in my own case when my lawyer started introducing or filing motions, reading the motions, and then she got muzzled and she could not speak a word anymore. She had to file everything in writing. You have still, as a defense lawyer, the motion to have the judge read something into the record. Like, I'm accused of having incited the masses to hatred by having written a book that challenges the mainstream narrative. So, okay, what we want is that all the judges, lay judges as well as professional judges, and the public hears what I'm accused of. So I file the motion, judge, please read or have read the book out loud in the courtroom. I'm not allowed to say anything that you must mean. Now I motion you to read it. You know, everyone should take notice and must take notice of what I'm going to be sentenced for. Therefore, you read it. You must read it, yeah, because you can't hide from the public what I'm accused of. Then they have the law that says they can order all participants in the court to read it at home.
Jeez. It sounds like so many ways they've found to make sure that this kind of information doesn't escape. Like, it's
right,
contained in a little containment.
Happens in my case too. In my lectures on the Holocaust, I wanted it read out. We read it at home. And everyone next day assures, yes, I've read it. Sure, you read a 500 books in a day. 500 page book in a day. Yeah, sure.
Right, right.
Good so Lord. Complete silent in the courtroom. The only thing that they can't have found a way of stopping is that the defendant himself is allowed to make statements, unlimited in time and topic, as long as it is conducive to the case, which I've taken ample advantage of in my case, and I've written a book about it. It's called Resistance is Obligatory, which is basically my defense speech. I've given a 7.5-day defense speech on if you search for obligatory or resistance,
in the search bar
on the top, to search for the resistance. Yeah, and it should come up. It takes a while. Is it churning? Have you kicked its ass? No, it's still blinking. You need to take. Yeah.
Hit it a few anyway. Times. Okay, I'll leave it alone to where it goes.
Yeah. Talking about what is science? There it is. Resistance obligatory. That's the first one. Talking about what is science? What? How do we measure if something is scholarly or not? And what is the importance of what I just mentioned? You know, the fundamental human attitude of doubting, of searching for the truth and communicating, inalienable human rights, going through the history of mankind philosophy, quoting all kinds of big shots from Socrates to Aristotle to all kinds of philosophers, what they have said about the importance of questioning, of scrutinizing, of doubting, the evil anti-scholarly attitude of censorship, of suppressing, of declaring something a dogma, unquestionable, taboo, and so forth. So it's pitting against science against the state, what is happening here. I'm, as a scientist, I'm not saying that I'm always right. Science is always a path of, research is always a path of try and error. And error is inevitable and is a part of it. But you need to have the freedom to search and to err. Errare humanum est. You know, being wrong at times is just human. And it can't be made a crime, even if should I be wrong here and there. And then the issue of resistance. You know, at one point, when do we have to resist against oppression? Do we even have the right? The German constitution is one of the very few constitutions in the world where people have a right to an insurrection.
Wow.
Okay. I dramatize it a little bit. It's phrased differently. It basically says if any German has the right to resist anyone who wants to get rid of this constitutional order, if there is no other recourse possible. And then there's a big literature of what that means. And it basically means that the foundational principles, that's the division of powers, and then that there are elections. So foundational principles of a democracy, of a republic, and also inalienable human rights. And basically, if the government consistently suppresses any of the constitutionally guaranteed civil rights, this is a case of resistance, where people have the right to resist, and no recourse possible means if even the Constitutional High Court in Germany doesn't address your grievances but rubber stamps the government's suppression of free speech, then you have the right to resist. That's the case we have here, where the German Constitutional High Court has said, okay, the German penal law and the Constitution doesn't allow special laws to suppress certain views on certain topics, which is exactly what we have here. There's only one certain topic, that's the claim genocide committed under National Socialism, and only one certain opinion about it is suppressed. It's specifically a special law to suppress only one opinion about only one topic. That's, you can't get any more special about a censorship law, and it's so unconstitutional. And the Constitutional High Court, when challenged about it, said, well, yes, it is a special law, and therefore normally it should be illegal, but it is such a special case that the specialty of National Socialist persecution demands for special measures, and therefore this special law is specially exempted from being unconstitutional. So it's a constitutional high court saying black is white in this case. Black is white. You need to believe me. And this is when the right to resist, no, the obligation to resist. That's what we have learned. You put your foot down the first time the government steps on your feet, tramples your civil rights underfoot. That's the lesson we have learned from National Socialism. You don't wait until all civil rights are gone or constitutional institutions have been eviscerated. Then it's too late. You need to start when the government steps over the red line. That's when you put your foot down. And that's the right one I have. 7.5 days lecturing on the right to resist, also the tradition in the world, you know, big people like David Thoreau, Mahatma Gandhi, the big shots of civil disobedience, and I've all quoted them. That was possible. They couldn't stop me there. I wasn't getting into historical claims because my first proclamation that tried was no judge has ever the right to pass judgment on what version of history is true and what is not. Therefore, I will not argue this. You have no right. You have a right to judge as a judge to interpret the law, but you have no business messing with the task of any scholarly field and setting what is true and what is not, what can be claimed, what cannot. Because the moment you do it, you dictate. You're a dictator, and then I have the right and the obligation to resist. So I don't even consider it appropriate to ask, to introduce evidence, trying to prove my point to a judge. You're a judge. You're completely ignorant when it comes to history. You're not an expert, no matter how much I tell you. You can form your private opinion about whether you find my evidence convincing or not, but it's not none of your business to pass judgment of whether I'm right or wrong. My peers in the field of history do that in civilized discussions, but you judges need to stay out of it. It's no government's business to define what's right or wrong when it comes to any field of scholarly study.
No, it seems like a massive overstep, and it does seem like another way that power is put into the wrong hands there, especially when they've gone so far over the edge with this stuff. Let me ask you, with the world kind of waking up more to the nature of some of this stuff, are you optimistic? Do you think that there is do you think that it's wise for us to be cautiously optimistic that more and more people are going to start questioning what we're told happened and what we should do in response to what we're told happened?
I've had several points in my life where I was optimistic and I was disappointed. So I'm careful with this. I'm always hoping. Hope is the last thing to die. I wouldn't say I'm an optimist. After what I have seen, there were waves of enthusiasm. The first one was after the collapse of the Soviet Union and the opening of archives. There was a lot of enthusiasm and interest, even from libertarian conservative circles. But then the system increased persecution, introduced new laws, and the repression became so bad that it all got stifled. So at the end of the day, unfortunately, censorship works. Right. And the system so far, each time there was an upsurge in the interest in that and success, the reaction was draconian suppression on a commercial level and on a judicial level. And I see that now with you know, the arrests that are starting with Mahmoud Khalil having been only the first one. I've seen that more have been arrested. They don't even say the names anymore. So there's a lot going on. The repression is being stepped up again. And we'll have to see. At some point, the threshold of pain is too much for people to take. Then they'll just put up with persecution and step up to the plate and won't be silenced anymore. This is my hope. I'm looking at most of my fellow humans when it comes to courage to do what they know is right in spite of disadvantages you have is not the common attitude. It is the exception. As long as people fear negative repercussions economically and socially, most will back down. And with most, I say 95-98% of the people. And as long as the pain isn't bigger than the disadvantage, this is going to prevail, unfortunately.
I think that's a correct assessment of the psychology of all this and the motivation dynamics at play. Let me ask you about the Trump thing, because that's kind of what you've been referencing. So Trump, of course, made this executive order basically trying to go after anti-Semitism. And part of this was he claimed that they were going to start throwing people out of the country, which is what you've been referencing. You think that they're going to really get away with that to a degree? Because I think there has been a pretty good pushback from the court system on this already in the case of the Mahmoud, I think, as you mentioned his name is.
Yes.
Yeah.
I don't know. It's anyone's guess. Trump has rigged the Supreme Court to the point where he was already given a kind of absolute immunity. This is something that really made me, figuratively speaking, throw up, because that's the last thing we need, to have a king kind of immunity for the person with the most power already. Anyway, I'm closely observing it. I am hoping, again, that the courts will stop him. Ultimately, I think it will end up with the Supreme Court will stop him. I've seen back when my case was going through the federal courts and the Supreme Court, they did not stop the government back then to have me deported.
Wow.
So there is a realistic chance they will not stop him. That sets the precedent. Back then, I was entitled to get a green card. I had all the paperwork and everything was ready, and I just hadn't ticked the last box of actually getting the green card, and they prevented me from doing it and deported me before that. Now, Khalil has the green card, and theoretically that should prevent the system from being allowed to deport him. But after 9/11, we have the Patriot 1, Patriot 2 Act, where they are, with reference to national security and so forth, new laws have been introduced with that allows them to bypass the normal law and even have in-camera hearings that are not public. As I just mentioned, court hearings should be public so that the public has a way of controlling what's going on. There are in-camera hearings where they are not public. There's the ability of the prosecution to withhold evidence from the defense for national security reasons. And they can claim anything. The defense cannot scrutinize it. So if push comes to shove, when they go this extreme route, and I've seen that happen to my friend Ernst Zernel, and that was back in 2003, 2004, 2005, right after 9/11, when they, in Canada and also here in the U.S., use those new Patriot laws to get rid of dissidents they didn't like. So I'm not too sanguine that the judiciary will stop it. I hope I keep a close eye on it, because it can have impact on my own life, a very serious one.
So they deported you the one time or multiple times?
Once in 2005. Yes.
I was not aware that they had used the Patriot Act stuff against Ernst Zundel.
Yes, Canada did. Right, they put him in solitary confinement, had in-camera hearings that were not public, and they withheld evidence from the defense. So Ernst Zundel never saw the kind of evidence that was claimed linked him to extremist organizations, to terrorist organizations that made him allegedly a national security threat. It's the same kind of rhetoric that's now levied against Mahmoud Khalil and any other people. And the government has, if they go down the Patriot Act route, has the right to withhold that from the public and from the defense. There's no way of defending yourself against evidence that you don't see and know. They right. can claim anything and make up anything. And I'm pretty sure they do make up anything.
Yeah, well, it throws accountability out the window. The system can have its way with you and how much you can do about it. That's pretty horrible, actually. Pretty horrible. Would you be okay to go to questions and this sort of thing?
Sure.
Okay, cool. Let's check them out. Stop this. Let's back up here. And let's go ahead and check them out. All right. Nature Love says, Gemar is a great man. Thank you for your work. Uncle would be proud. Going to be ordering that encyclopedia soon. Very cool. Suggest you do. Nature Love. Love and Division.
Yeah, there's the internet kill switch, which people are not aware of. Right now, you can get it at holocaustencyclopedia.com all free of charge, and there's even a downloadable app that you can have. But we have external and internal forces that can turn that off anytime.
I think Gimmer's connection. Oh, I think I'm good. I think his connection shut out. Let's see if he's going to connect. Let's check the Zoom connection here. Oh, froze. I think I'll pop back in. No, he's right. The internet kill switch is a reality. Let me just pull that up while I'm waiting to see if he can connect. Little switch. So, yeah, so the internet kill switch is a countermeasure concept of activating a single shutoff mechanism of all internet traffic. The concept behind having a kill switch is based on creating a single point of control, i.e. a switch, or a single authority to control or shut down the internet in order to protect it or its users. They're going to protect us. You guys feel protected. Because of infrastructure and society's dependence on the internet today, including critical infrastructure and services, example, healthcare emergencies, traffic, etc., internet kill switch can easily and clearly be deemed collective punishment. Therefore, in the United States, groups such as the ACLU have criticized proposals for implementing the idea so far. Well, apparently they did anyway. Obama did, actually. I think. I can't tell if camera's having problems getting back in. Let me just. Sure. Messenger. Okay. Just gonna adjust this here. So let me go into the Obama thing. Oh yeah. I hope it hasn't been for the whole time, Amalek. I'll have to fix that in post. I hope that wasn't consistently the thing. Turn it up just in case when he comes back. Oh, there he is. Hey.
I have to apologize. No, I hate Windows. Windows decided without notifying me that it needs to update and restart my computer. Believe it or not, that's just what happened.
It happens. It's crazy. I know exactly what you're talking about. That's nuts, but I believe you. They made me do that before I came on too, actually. So it's...
Fortunately, I have SSD, so it goes really quick. So otherwise, I would have been out here for I don't know how long. So. Apologize. Anyway, the kill switch, there was not an example of it, even though it just killed me for offline for a while. The problem with Holocaust skepticism right now is that we have too many eggs in too few baskets. And so if you take a key player like me out, for instance, because I say I fear that I could be targeted one way or another, it can happen at any time. And if that happens, the structure can become unstable. I don't know what the future would be if people would be able and willing and do actually step up to the plate to fill the gap that would be left behind. It's not easy to tell. But there's always internal strife that we had to struggle with. At one point, we had a guy become jealous of success that I was having. And a complex story anyway, he tried to take control of things and try to extort money from the organizations I was involved in. So there are two things, the internal and external strife, that can lead to things becoming unstable. Therefore, it is a good idea to think that what you see online, freely accessible right now, could indeed be wiped off tomorrow. So having the hard copy is something that is a good repository to have that cannot be wiped off the internet. Yes.
This is really cool, too. I mean, there's so many great different things in here. I've been showing people this for a while, like this wonderful chart.
You got a paperback copy. Yeah, we don't have a paperback edition anymore because it is a little bit unstable. It's a very heavy book, and if you put that in the shelf upright, it will probably bend. So we decided not to issue. So, also, most people would buy the hard copy.
I should have got the hard copy. That's my only regret.
Yeah. So we decided we don't let people make that mistake anymore. It's just a $5 more cost in the production, and we actually have charged only $4 more for the hard copy, thinking people, if the difference between paperback and hard copy is only $4, and we're talking $100 that the thing costs itself.
Yeah.
Who wouldn't go for the hard copy? But some people didn't. Anyway, you can't anymore. There's only a hard copy right now because the paperback was just too unstable. And getting customer complaints that the binding is not up to it with that kind of a heavy book. So we decided not to do that anymore. Yeah.
I guess I got it too early.
we're right now, the third edition, we are putting out a new edition pretty much every year. The third edition just came out in January, and we're already preparing the fourth because, as I mentioned, there are a number of editions being translated now, and we get feedbacks from the translators and editors of minor issues here and there. It has actually a change log on the website. If you go on the right-hand side, scroll down, and it has pages of general interest that says change log
there is change log,
and you can see all the changes that have been implemented in preparation of edition number 4 that I put in just yesterday on the 14th. Minor stuff, but it keeps on scrolling, so all the changes I've done, a few words and expressions here just to correct things a little bit. It's no big things, not that if you have an old edition, you would tell wrong stories about the stuff. It's still pretty much accurate. It's only minor stuff that had been corrected. But it's always good to get feedback and to improve on things. And they always have a most recent version out there. And people are more likely to buy a book that was published in 2025, and it is 2012, than to buy a book that was published in 2005. It's like with a car, right? You want to always, if you buy a new car, you want it to be the latest edition, the latest version.
Yeah.
And if a manufacturer can update a car every year, that makes it more attractive. And with a print on demand, which that is, we can basically issue a new edition every year and make it always up to date and look new and be new.
Yeah, absolutely. So, somebody was asking why some of the book is in dollars and some in pounds, or I guess different books that were offered in the bookstore. I didn't note that.
The Holocaust Encyclopedia website itself is American based, and therefore it has the prices in US dollars. However, the company itself is London based, as I mentioned earlier, and therefore their prices are in British pounds. Mm-hmm. In theory, we could use a currency switcher where people can just switch between two currencies. Credit card companies dislike that because it confuses people. They don't know which currency it is now and which price is what. And therefore, we had actually credit card processing companies deny our services or increase the fees that we have to pay if we offer two currencies. Now, in today's world, on the internet, you find currency converters, the currency rates, and you can easily figure out what that means in US dollars. If you pay with your debit card, no matter what country you're in, it gets charged the pound amount, and whatever credit card your company is registered in, your car, what rephrase, whatever country your debit card is registered in, where your bank is, will automatically convert your purchase currency to your bank's currency. And at a pretty decent rate, so not ripping you off like you go with cash at an exchange place in a tourist town where they rip you off. No, bank exchange rates are really reasonable and the fees are minimal. So, and actually foreign transaction fees we get charged with, not the customer. So it's automatic. You get charged in whatever your domestic currency is. We have customers all over the world. In the Euro countries, South Africa, Australia, New Zealand, you name them, and they come with all kinds of currencies. The main market is the United States, but the company is in London for reasons, as I just mentioned. We had a hostile takeover attempt here in the United States, and to make this whole enterprise safe from a takeover in this country, we moved the whole operation to England. So the kill switch, as I mentioned, are internal and external threats. Holocaust skepticism is always struggling financially because there's so much attempt of trying to undermine our business. When, for instance, when you look at the books we offer, you try to find them on Amazon, they don't exist. We had everything in international book distribution. You could find them for the most part until end of last year on all other platforms other than Amazon. But then Ingram Content Group, which has a monopoly in the United States for book distribution. Every publisher funnels their book through Ingram, and Ingram then distributes them to all online and offline booksellers, including Amazon. Ingram got pressured by Amazon to kill our account. So all of our books disappeared from the worldwide market. Now we don't want to have this vulnerability anymore, and therefore most of our book we don't even put into distribution anymore. So most of our books you can get only from our bookstore, and a very few select ones that buy directly from us. So we try to do direct marketing so that we're not vulnerable by this kind of censorship activity. But at the end, having customers all over the world who directly buy from us would mean we have to offer everyone's currency that they prefer or have in their country. It's just not possible.
Yeah.
So we settled with what the processors in Great Britain accept as the currency, because the current company is in Great Britain. If you want to have processing in Great Britain for a company in Great Britain, they demand that it be in British pounds. I can't put dollars on there. It's not going to fly.
No, that's a perfect explanation as to why. That makes sense. Lovin Division said he wanted to ask a question, but it is blocked. I fixed that. He later asks, does Gimmer have a view on the misinformation surrounding General Patton's wish to use surrendered German soldiers to finish off communist Russia? Specifically, the excuse that Patton's plan was turned down on the grounds that the Allies wanted no more war, like Stalin saying no more sin. That sound clear?
Yeah, I'm familiar with that. It wasn't just Patton. I think there had been more than just Patton among the generals. Patton was the general who was most gung-ho of keep going. And the problem at the end of the war, that decision would have been a little late by that point. Everyone was exhausted, and to sell that to the American public to keep going and then fight the Russians right there would have been a tough sale, to put it mildly. I don't think it would have flown. The issue is much earlier, when Germany and Soviet Russia got into a fight in June 1941. The question would have been then how the United States should have reacted to that. Standing by the side of England is one thing, but if you consider objectively which two countries were getting into war against each other. You had one dictatorship who had a dismal human rights record, that is Third Reich Germany, and you had the other dictatorship, much more totalitarian, Bolshevist Russia, whose civil rights record was way worse. I always kind of give people a tally of the victim toll that the Third Reich had by the time the war broke out in 1939. By that time, roughly 1,000 people had died on the hands of National Socialist policies. Yet the Röhm Putsch, with a couple of dozen SA members leaders who were massacred in the Night of Long Knives. And then you had the Kristallnacht pogrom in November, 38, I think 100 Jews died in those pogroms, roughly. And then you had, of course, people who were in the concentration camps. Some of them died. They wouldn't probably not have died had they not been incarcerated. And some of them were just politically prisoners. Not all of them, but most of them. Whereas Russia, when the war started, or Soviet Union, and they invaded Poland together with Germany, by that time, the Bolshevist regime had 10 or 20 million victims. So we're talking 1,000 against 10 million. That is a factor of 10,000. Five orders of magnitude worse human rights, because when we're just looking at the death toll, I'm not talking about the totalitarian suppression, which was much worse than the Soviet Union and the Third Reich. So why would you side in that war with Soviet Russia? The moment anyone sides with Soviet Russia in that war, you stop fighting the good fight and you start fighting the bad fight. I'm not saying that you should have joined Germany in that fight. It's whatever decision you make, the taking sides would have been. If you are objective and you want both regimes to go away and collapse, then you would look to it that these two keep fighting each other to complete exhaustion where both of them collapse. But that's not what happens. The Soviet Union would have collapsed in 1942, late in 1943 at the latest, had it not been for the massive support that the Soviet Union got from the United States. Right. The United States, already prior to the war in the 1930s, with Roosevelt picking up diplomatic relationships, most people don't know, Roosevelt was the one who started diplomatic relationships with the Soviet Union. The United States did not recognize the Soviet government as a legitimate government of Soviet of Russia until Roosevelt came in. And then he started having trade relationships with Soviet Union that were massively beneficial for the industrialization of Russia. Stalinism forced industrialization, which was aimed almost exclusively at war industries, to build an army that was gargantuan in dimensions and was meant to conquer all of Europe, if not all of the world. After all, the Bolshevist idea was a world revolution that was not just talk. And since the revolution didn't work, they decided we're going to do it with war. The United States helped, under Roosevelt, helped the Soviet Union to industrialize and build the army they did build. And then they equipped and furnished both war materials as well as raw materials to the Soviet Union during the entire war that kept the machine going. And if you look at the right-hand man of Roosevelt, his name was Wallace, I think, at the end of the war under the McCarthy frenzy, he fled to the Soviet Union. Roosevelt was a sick man, particularly during the war, and he was not capable of running the country anymore. And his right-hand man who was doing the foreign policy, in particular with the Soviet Union, was Wallace, I think his name. And he was the Soviet plant, So ultimately, you could say, with some degree of justification, that the Soviet undermining of the Roosevelt administration had come to such a degree that Stalin was pretty much running the U.S. government when it comes to foreign policy, in particular the policy to the Soviet Union.
Did you say his right-hand man was William Loeb?
Wallace, I think. I'm not quite sure anymore. I've
I searched it. It came up with William Loeb Jr., but search for a right-hand man.
Let me see, because we had an article on him that was by Hadding Scott.
Henry A. Wallace?
Jewish propaganda and Soviet infiltration. That is on Kodo. No, it's not. It's not right. You're right. Where's the guy's name? Anyway, I could probably post you the link here in the chat. And you can look it up.
Okay.
Hopkins. Oh. Harry Hopkins. So I was completely off with Wallace. Harry Hopkins. Okay. Anyway, so that's where the problem is. Patton came before the McCarthy cleanup of the Soviet government by removing all the Soviet infiltrators and going a little bit over the top by going after everyone that was communist leaning. But at the end, you look at particularly the details as it's laid out by Hadding Scott in this paper, you realize that the U.S. Roosevelt administration was, when it comes to foreign pay, was run by Stalin. And the Germans knew it. They saw that as a Jewish conspiracy, Roosevelt with Jewish background. And if you look at the McCarthy going after the spies and infiltrators, most of them, if not most of them, were Jewish. The whole conspiracy of betraying the nuclear secrets to the Soviet Union was all Jewish. Now, if you look at most of the scientists who had developed the nuclear bomb, many of them were Jewish, from Oppenheimer to Teller to Sinti. They were all Jews out to build a weapon to genocidally clean the Germans off the map. Wipe the Germans off the map. That was the program's purpose. Of course, the Germans surrendered before that could happen, and then the Japanese felt the heat, literally and figuratively speaking. Wait. So Patton had no way of getting anywhere with this. The problem was ultimately way, way deeper in the system of being basically run by Stalin.
Wow. That's quite a lot. No, it's true. Wow. Okay. Yeah. So there was no way out of that one. Yeah. It's interesting to see what happened with the atomic bombs and the secrets there. So obviously the Rosenbergs were executed, but there was a lot of others sneaking out nuclear secrets, right?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, the same again with the State of Israel. Huh? That's the same situation there. Right. How did they get that?
Oh, absolutely.
20 years later, same game again.
Pretty wild. I wonder if they feel, I mean, I'm sure they would anyway, but they probably feel entitled to them with this massive history of all their right. people building it in the first place. Yeah, even just searching it, it says Edward Teller, Eugene Wigner, Luis Szilard. Or Szilard, I guess, rather, all Hungarian Jews. Yeah, so there you go. From Vienna came Victor Weisskopf. Yeah. Wow. Quite a collection. Also of note, somebody did say they did find the encyclopedia on Amazon. So it's kind of cool. Did you say it was taken now?
Don't jinx it. Don't jinx it.
Okay, I mean, never mind. It's not on Amazon. Go to nukebook.com. Com and you can find it.
Nukebook.org or encyclopedia, holocaustencyclopedia.com. Yeah, it has a nickname. It's the Nuke Book. It nukes the mainstream narrative to oblivion.
That's cool. I like that. I always like that. That's a great thing. Okay, let's see where this goes next. Okay, Amalek International, he asks, there is deafening silence from Christians regarding the Jewish destruction of Palestine Arabs. Indeed, many evangelicals even support what's happening as fulfillment of biblical prophecy. What role does Gamar think Christianity has had in allowing Jews to gain the global supremacy they now have?
Christianity is a Jewish sect. If you look at the Bible, 90%, you know, you have the four Gospels, which is the same story told over again. You take them as one, it's 100 pages, and then you have some letters of Paul, and the New Testament is such a tiny part of the complete Bible. 90% of Christianity is the Old Testament, and that's 100% Jewish. I've gone to church for most of my life. Right now I'm not part of parish, but no matter what Christian church you go to, you have two readings, one from the New Testament and one from the Old Testament. And Christianity is a Jewish sect. What kind of role does a Jewish sect play in giving legitimacy to another Jewish sect? So there's, you know, two branches from the same stem.
Yeah.
I would say if it weren't for Christianity, Judaism wouldn't exist anymore. Judaism was a tribal religion of the little, small people in the Middle East that would have disappeared and merged with surrounding new ideas and ideologies, like all the other Stone Age tribal religions. And I'm pretty sure it basically is already gone. It didn't survive in the Middle East so much as it did survive in Christian Europe. That's where the Jews came from that are now in Israel, which the original Jews never left Palestine and converted first to Christianity and later in the 7th and 8th century to Islam for the most part. The Palestinians who are being suppressed by the Jews in Israel and ethnic Finns, these are the descendants of what used to be Jews 2,000 years ago. They are your real Jews. First converted mostly to Christianity in Christian Rome, when all of Rome converted officially to Christianity in the 3rd century AD. And then with Muhammad and his successors, violent conquest of the Middle East in Northern Africa, starting in the 7th century, many of them converted to Islam, and a few only remained Jews. And what you have now, the Jews, they are Europeans of various descendants, various ancestry. So, sorry, I'm getting a little bit off on a tangent here.
No, it's an important question. It's certainly one that causes a lot of strife and emotional responses in this community. Well, these communities, I guess. But you know, it needs to be spoken of honestly. And nobody can argue that the Old Testament isn't fundamentally Jewish. I mean, it's the Torah. That's not right. Really debatable, I don't think. I guess there are some new sects of Christianity, like Christian Identity, I guess, that try to say that Jesus is not, that Jesus is white, Aryan, I guess.
Yeah. I mean, I've grown up a Catholic, and I was even a conservative pre-Vatican Catholic for a while. And the past 12 years, I have been regular religiously weekly attendant of a Lutheran community. And when I'm asked, what am I? I said, I'm a social Christian, but dogmatic agnostic. Because I've been raised in this cultural context and church has been my home for so long. I've been involved in youth activities and as a student, young adult, in Catholic student fraternities. And to this day, I have friends within the Catholic priesthood and even bishops. there is just so much connection, so much of my identity and raising and bringing up is intertwined with Christianity that I don't try to get out of it. My moral framework, my everything when it comes to my coordinates comes from that. That's just my history and my part of my personality. So I'm not trying to get out of it. But when it comes to being realistic of assessing what's what and where's what coming from, that Judaism is getting justification, ideological, moral, political justification from Christianity more than from anything else, that it would have disappeared had it not been for Christianity giving it this legitimacy or this apparent legitimacy, is for me an obvious fact. Also trying to fight Judaism is a fool's errand, because if you go against Judaism, against Jews, in any which shape or form, you will face the opposition of hundreds of millions of Christians. Yeah. And I have one acquaintance who thinks there should be, as I mentioned, there are some extremists that I completely disagree with who think there must be a physical solution to the Jewish question. National Socialism had a radical racial approach to Judaism, not realizing that if you oppose Judaism, particularly on an ethnic or racial basis, you are making enemies with the majority of Christianity. Because for them, they are the chosen people. And so if hypothetically you were to kill 6 million Jews, you would have 60 million Christians converting to Judaism. Then you have to kill 60 million Jews. If you then want to kill these 60 million Jews, you will have 600 million Christians converting to Judaism. You're going to make your problem worse. The more you go after Jews because of the Christians, not because of the Jews. The Jews get their legitimacy. If you look at the numbers, they would never have the power over the world, over the Western world, as they do, because based solely on their number. It's because they are giving this power by the majority of Zionist-inclined Christians who get their identity to a large degree from the Old Testament. So that's undeniable fact.
Yeah, there's some pastors that really stick out. Greg Locke was one that came to mind. Let me put this one up since I just saw it here. Ruby says, on the Farsi translation of Holocaust Encyclopedia, an idea. Gamera could email Ron Unz and ask if he could contact you with Press TV to see if they have a translator. Ron did a 3-hour talk on the Holocaust on Press TV. You have cachet, so Rob probably would help, and Press TV knows based and educated people. Think of that idea.
Okay, I can pass that on to the publisher. I keep my hands out of this because I don't want to end up being deported for cooperating with a terrorist government.
Fair enough. that's
don't laugh about it. It's not funny.
You're right. It's not serious. Yeah, it's very serious. Yeah. It's just crazy that would be considered that, but I fully get it. Yeah, it's not good.
Yeah. You know that Trump is now considering to enforce what is this, or to apply the Alien Enemies Act.
Mm.
So that any person who is already now, any person who is supportive of or associated with a terrorist government or terrorist organization can be prosecuted. And when it's an immigrant, can be deported. So if I were to be caught with my hands in that cookie jar, that could be a deportation ticket for me.
Absolutely, yeah.
So I'm staying out of this. Now, what my publisher in London does with it is their business. Right now, a lot of things going on. I sold my copyright, and it's in their court, and I get suggestions for corrections, and I can put in the English back in, but that's as much as I get involved. I don't want more trouble in more countries. Because,
I understand.
Yeah, so there's only so much heat that you can take.
Absolutely. Absolutely true. Renuna Kate, she said, thank you for having this wonderful guest. Well, thank you, Renuna Kate. I appreciate your support.
Still people awake at this time of the day listening to us, huh?
It's true, almost. We're getting to the end there. Giuseppe Vaffanculo, he says, another excellent episode of the Gold Standard of White Nationalist Program. Thank you, Giuseppe. I appreciate you, man. That's a very flattering reference, but I don't know if I agree, but I appreciate it. Diorelte Fritz, he asks a question for Herr Rudolf. Do you know of a place online to find the transcripts to Einsatzgruppen trials that were held in Langenreich, Berlin in the 50s and 60s, or can these only be obtained in person?
Transcripts are usually kept in the court files. So there's Landgericht Berlin, that's the district court in Berlin. Whether they have been handed over now but to some archive, be it the Federal Archives in Berlin or Koblenz or the Zentrale Stelle back in Ludwigsburg, I do not know. Fact of the matter is that if they are still in the court files, getting access to this is a little bit of a struggle because usually you need to have a legal reason to get access to those files. If they are in archives, then after we started getting access to archival material in the 1990s, Germany instituted a new law to require anyone to have either a accreditation with the university or a reference letter, a recommendation by a person, a university associated person. So they want to make sure that independent researchers and dissidents don't get access to archival material. If I were to go there, I mean, I wouldn't be able to get to Germany. I have no passport. They deny me the passport. They have arrest warrants out for me. and Carlo Montagna has too. So we can't go to Germany. If we snuck in and showed up at a archive, we would not get access. And we would probably just get a call to the police and they would arrest us. So it's difficult to get to archival material for us. Fortunately, we have some historians who work with us who are accredited and who don't tell the public that they work with us. And they may give, sometimes on request, they search for material for us and can get it to us. So there is some subversive support in certain circles, and it's good to know. So historians may have not a lot of backbones, but there are a few who have a little bit of it. It's enough to have this kind of support.
That's very neat. I mean, it sucks. That's the reality, of course, but it's very neat that there's some historians that see that that's the right thing to do, to
right.
Slip you guys the truth by the back channel. Wow, that's quite a thing. You know, I have to say, this whole thing where they keep materials sequestered away and there's this extreme credentialism that has to go in before people are allowed access to them, even when seriously studying this stuff, that's as much as anything a part of keeping this whole myth alive, basically, is by keeping the actual information so contained and so hard to verify for most people who would be interested. That makes it, you have to trust somebody. You have to start trusting someone's version of the story. And the easiest one is just take the mainstream version.
Right.
Oh, there's one more question there. Strathmore, he asks, Gamer, do you think Holocaust revisionism is necessary before white collectivization against Jewish power could happen? Or is there already enough awareness combined with the current happenings of Jewish transgressions to provide the will for change?
Good question. Next question.
I think
people should smarten up on that topic, because accusations of denial, even if not committed, will come. This is a weapon, as I mentioned, it's a sword and shield of Judaism and Zionism, and to some degree the intellectual left, that is good to have an antidote against. That is good to know your story. So in case you are being badgered with what the Germans call the Auschwitz Club or the Holocaust Club, that you have defenses at the ready, know how to defend yourself, to smartly defend yourself, not come up with cliches or wrong perceptions that make you end up with the egg on the face. I wouldn't say it's necessarily required. As long as you don't have to touch it or face it, it's probably better staying out of it and keep the topics, the discussions to the topics that you're really interested in. But you should be able to face the music if it's coming. So it's good to have in your armory.
Absolutely. Thanks. I believe we're at the end of those questions and comments. Thank you, Ruby, as well. I think we're at the end. Well, I really appreciate you coming on, Mr. Rudolph, and I wish you the best, man. I really hope they don't. The Trump thing with the anti-Semitism and trying to deport anti-Semites and this sort of stuff, that's a really dirty political move, and I hope they don't actually come at you like that. But
it's the most ridiculous charge. You know, Mahmoud Khalil is a Semite because Semites are the people who speak Arabic. That's the definition of Semites. And the original Jews are part of the Semitic languages are Arabic and Hebrew. That's pretty much all that's left over. But most Jews who've immigrated to Israel are not Semitic in an ethnic sense. So I would say 98% of people who are Semitic are Arabic. Anti-Semitism is the completely wrong word. And anti-Judaism or anti-Zionism, depending on what approach you have. You know, say in this country, the vast majority of Zionists are Christian. So there are many more Christian Zionists. You know, you have, 6 million Jews in this country, or what is it? 4 million? I don't know. Half of them may be Zionists by confession, and some others may be Pavlovian reflex Zionists. But when it comes to Christians, you know, we have, 200 million Christians in this country, and you could probably say 50 million of them are staunch Zionists, and 50 or 100 million more are Pavlovian reflex Zionists. So the real issue here is anti-Zionism and anti-Judaism, if you want to. Inter-Judaism is an ideological stance. It's not a racial stance. Inter-Jewishness is then a racial or ethnic attitude. So these are various terms that distinguish more and define more accurately what you're doing, what you're thinking, what you're aiming at. Anti-Semitism makes no sense as a term.
Yeah, no, it absolutely doesn't. You know, they put that on the executive order, but now you're right. It's a ridiculous term, like many of these terms. Any final thoughts on what you would leave the people with as far as how they should approach this stuff? Because I think a lot of people are fed up that know, they know that they've been lied to about this, and they want to find a way to resist this. Any ideas to leave them with?
And the Holocaust Encyclopedia is, of course, a massive work, and it's good to have that. If you want to start much slower and on a smaller scale, I really would recommend to get the little book that I published that I mentioned earlier, the Nazi Gas Chambers, The Roots of the Story. There it is. That is a 5x8-inch small book. It just has roughly 100 pages of text. So it's a relatively quick and easy read. It gives you all the core important information and also immunizes you against the idea this is a Jewish conspiracy, because it's not how it started. It's much more complex. It's embedded in the German-Polish conflict and in the East-West Cold War. That's actually the root of the story, most of it grew. And that can save you from the fallacy of going down this Jewish conspiracy track, which is wrong, but also which would cause you additional problems that you don't need. So get the facts straight, smarten up with that. That should probably be the easiest way of getting a start and getting good information on that issue.
That's really good advice. Check it out. I will put the link around and I'll post it in the description as well. Well, yeah. Mr. Rudolph, I really appreciate your time. I appreciate you coming on, and I really do hope you are not having any trouble with that, because it's a fucked up law, and I don't think they should be doing it. So, but I'm sure you'll be all right. We'll keep our fingers crossed and think you'll be okay. But I really appreciate you. I appreciate your work, and I do absolutely encourage people to get one or both books and learn about it.
Okay. Much appreciated. Yes.
Have a good night.
You too. Okay. Bye.
A little view here somewhere. Is there... Thought I did. Wow. Got it without all the trappings, I guess, huh? Okay, well, there we go. Check this out. I'll probably check that one out myself. I do not know the story of the origins with the Polish and Stalinist Polish origins of the gas chamber myth. That's very interesting. I did not know that. I had put it to the Allies, but not Stalin and the original.
The Allies went on for the ride during the war. We're of course chiming in there too, but the origin really came from the Polish underground and the Soviets with gas van claims. So that came from their end and culminated there and was then really solidified and coordinated in Poland. So the Western Allies, they had a little bit of initial claims of gas chamber claim, Mauthausen and Dachau and so forth, but that kind of dropped in 1948 when the Cold War broke out. They didn't want to arrest the Germans anymore. They wanted them as allies, and therefore the Western Allies kind of stopped this. They passed all kinds of laws of amnesty and early release of people who were still incarcerated and stopped any further prosecution of trials. So that was kind of over in 1948 when it comes to the Western powers. Now, they were, of course, all swept away with the propaganda as it spread and consumed the entire planet. And everyone is now trapped in it by believing it, because the way the story was created by Poland and Soviet Russia has captivated the Germans, the West Germans, and when the West Germans, you know, the Germans officially rubber stamp it as correct, what's anyone else going to say? Are they going to be more German and more defense of the Germans than the German government themselves? No. So if they say it happened, then it must have happened.
It's such an incredible ball of wax and treachery that I don't know how that gets unraveled. You know, where does that begin? Where does it begin that people understand the nefarious origins of this and then start working at it in mass? Or does it require that? Maybe it's a better follow-up question actually there on does it require an en masse response, or is it maybe just the right people finding out? I think.
Well, I think if we get more and more influences on on podcasts and so forth to address this issue, to bring it to people, to make it mainstream, to make it accept, socially acceptable to question, to reject, to scrutinize, to discuss this issue in a controversial manner. That would be enough. I don't have to convince everyone, but if you dismiss this as propaganda or irrelevant, or I don't know, but this is, you know, everyone knows that something's fishy about it, that takes the blunt off the effectiveness of this weapon. Blunts the weapon and can even to some degree turn into something that backfires on whoever's trying to use it. So not everyone has to smarten up completely. You have to have just enough influences. You know, at the end of the day, none of us can be expert at everything and know everything. We rely on the experts. We rely on certain people. And in the times of social media, we often rely on our favorite channels. And if you have just enough influences, putting it out in the mainstream and making it socially acceptable, then I think that's all it takes.
Mm. I think it is that social fear the most that keeps people muzzled. It's got to be, as well as just not knowing.
If it's not a stigma anymore, for which the bank can cancel your account, your employer can fire you, if it's something that everyone kind of does or could do, then we've won.
Yeah.
You know?
You said that kind of answers a question somebody wanted. They said, what does winning look like for a gamer? Well, there you go. It's I guess you just said it. Right. Okay. Well, I guess that's probably all I think I have. Appreciate you coming on, sir. Have a good night.
Yeah. Good night.
Good night. Okay, let me do a quick thank yous again, really run down here. Nature Love, Love and Division, Amalek International, Love and Division, Der Alte Fritz, and He's in the Juice. Thank you, sirs. And then, okay, thank you to Renata Kate. Renata Kate. And what was the last one? Oh, right. Strathmore and Giuseppe Vaffanculo. With you. I believe that's everybody. I think we got them all. Missed something? Something. Oh, yeah, I did. Oh, crap. Oh, no. There's a couple more on Entropy. Ruby also says, shoot. I think Jim already left. I believe he did. Oh, no, maybe he didn't. He had one more question. Shoot. If he's still there, I think I'll pull him back. And that's a very belated exit. Sorry, Sarah, jumping back and forth here.
okay.
Ruby said, for Gamer, when reading a historical work, when reading a historical work or certain citations, it's not practical to check every citation, if only reading out of curiosity. Do you have a rule of thumb for the number or percentage of citations you'll check before you establish some trust in a historical work?
Well, I'd say that way. I'm getting typescripts of authors who want us to publish a book on my computer on occasion. I just had one submitted a few days ago. And I have an approach. First of all, I look, does it have a bibliography? What are the kind of sources that are quoted? And does it reference claims? So the quality of sources is probably what matters. If somebody grabs quotes from the internet only, and I see that there are some questionable websites, then I become suspicious that the quality can be rather low. If there are mainstream books or books that are probably published, which I can verify with WorldCat of the International Library website, where you can find pretty much all the books that exist in all libraries in the world. I can verify that they exist, or I see archival references. That's when it really gets interesting. Proper historical work relying on primary sources goes to archives and has definition of which archives I got it from and what the archival reference number is. I will not, for the most part, be able to check that because many archives have not digitalized their resources. Some do. So I'm looking at the kind of sources. Are they mainstream? Are they accessible to everyone? And are they reliable? Or is that mainly a journalistic background or even a social media background? And it really gets tricky because anything can be posted on social media. I have that with one book that's Tell the Truth and Shame the Devil by Gérard Menuhin. He was quoting a mixed bag of reliable sources and social media quotes, and I had to chase them all down. I did the work when we did the second edition of that book. I did the footwork of chasing down most of the sources because that is such a book that is so important with his claims about Jews and Judaism and Zionism. That I wanted to make sure we get that right, that every source that is quoted and there really exists, and I had interlibrary loan, the most obscure stuff, was chasing it down to get it, and I get my fingers on it. And if I not, we had to rewrite it, throw it out, replace it with something else. Quite some work. Sometimes, if a project is important and worth it, I will do the work as an editor and kick an author's butt to say, you need to get a proper source, proper reference for this, or else I will not publish it. And a serious author will do that then, would appreciate my work and effort put in there to get this book really up to a standard where it can withstand critical scrutiny and enemy attacks. That's ultimately what is needed, because if you write a book that can be disassembled and shown as phony and based on phony or unreliable sources, then it can backfire on you. It's not good. So sometimes, yeah, it requires a lot of work of chasing things down. But if you see that an author is actually sticking, like Carlo Martonio, he knows the archival sources. He gives exact addresses where the archives are and references. And he is not quoting journalistic sources and never goes to internet sources if he can help it, let alone social media quotes. So with him, I'm pretty sure I don't have to chase things down anymore. With new authors, I do that to a large degree to make sure I'm not ending up with my own foot in my mouth. I don't want that.
I think you'd agree credibility is extremely important in trying to confront these issues, because that's the first thing and the most obvious thing for them to go after is to try to undermine your credibility. So it seems that what you just described is a critical process in maintaining that credibility.
Absolutely.
Ruby also continues with another question. There's just, I'm assuming Ruby might be a she. Says, in the 70s, the defense's ability to introduce evidence was removed in Germany. West Germany? Was this just imposed in East Germany? So you already said no. After unification without protest? Or was this still less oppressive than when the Soviets had imposed? What the Soviets had imposed?
I don't know what the rules were in East Germany. I'm talking about West Germany. 1970s, West Germany saw terrorist attacks by the Red Army faction. That was a terrorist organization that was financed by East Germany and Moscow in order to destabilize the West. They were assassinating high-profile German industrialists, bankers, politicians. Ponto Buback Schleyer. The next is ein Bayer. Anyway, there are three high-profile people, and then later Herrhausen from the Deutsche Bank was murdered, presumably from the Red Army faction too, but that's a little bit in dispute. Anyway, trials were staged against some of those terrorists that were eventually captured, and the defense for those terrorists put up a formidable fight by trying to turn the trials into political show stages where they would try to justify those terrorists' political views with all kinds of ideological arguments. the German legislation didn't like that the courtroom was turned by these defense lawyers, who later on, actually, one of them, Schilly, became a minister in German government in the 1990s, and Gerhard Schröder actually became chancellor. He was one of the defense lawyers who was in the 1970s turning the courtroom into political propaganda agendas for the terrorists. So the legislative, the German Bundestag, the parliament, passed the law to withdraw completely the right of the defense to introduce any evidence so that they couldn't turn the courtroom into a staging ground for political propaganda. And of course, Schröder was then Bundeskanzler, Chancellor in Germany between 98 and 2000, and what was it, five, I think, I don't remember. It's quite interesting. And one of the defendants who was one of the ideological mainstays of the Red Army faction and who was one of the people who was turning it into a staging ground is Horst Mahler. And Horst Mahler in 1998, when Chancellor became his former defense lawyer, Schröder became German Chancellor, Horst Mahler turned revisionist because he had read my book, Lectures on the Holocaust. He made a 180-degree turn from left-wing terrorist to National Socialist, Holocaust skeptic, anti-Jewish polemicist, which wasn't exactly what I had in mind when I wrote my lectures. But anyway, it twists to the story. That's quite amazing. But that's the background of why the defense's right to introduce evidence was removed in West Germany in fight against left-wing terrorists. But then 20 years later onward, it is now used again. People perceived as right-wingers who are skeptical about the Holocaust and who just want to defend themselves by showing that they're right. And the same argument is used. Well, we deny you any defense, even punish you for trying to defend yourself, because you're using the courtroom as a show and staging ground to publicize your opinions, which are illegal. Now, the political defense of the right-wing, left-wing extremist terrorists back in the 70s were not considered illegal. You could distribute communist terrorist propaganda as long as you were not actually calling for violence and terrorist actions as much as you wanted. But it's different now. People on trial in Germany for Holocaust skepticism are not on trial because of terrorism, because of acts of violence, because of any crime in the understanding of most humans, but because they have a peaceful dissenting opinion on a chapter in history. And still, they're not allowed to argue their point.
Ruby actually continues, says, Gamer, we have an underground railroad to hide you from INS. You have pride and don't want to run, but you make a good point about Khalil's situation. Maybe it's worth the hassle to make yourself unfindable for the next 4 years? Question mark.
Take the fifth on that one.
Yeah. smart response. Rebel Science also says, great guest, quality show, love it. Well, salute to you, Rebel Science, and Ruby as well, salute to you. I think we're at the end of the questions for real this time. That's those fake outs there. But yeah, I think we better end it before I keep you here all night. It's such a fascinating wealth of understanding and knowledge. I probably could just probably pick your mind for hours, and you've already been here for several, so I don't want to abuse that privilege. So I appreciate you, Rudolph, and hopefully you'll come back sometime and tell us more, and you'll release a new book.
Yes, I'm about to.
Awesome. Well, let me know, because I'd be glad to help you promote it.
Yeah. Okay.
All right, sir.
Thank you.
Good night.
Good night.
One truth can break a foundation, as though it were made of glass. One truth can create.